call the Health Committee to order. And if I could ask, please, those who are guests today, if you'd take your seats, or if we could have order, we can begin our very important business today. Representative Emmer moves the minutes of our April 12th, April 19th, and April 11th meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have many people who would like to talk to us today, and I want to be respectful of each individual and also collectively. We've asked people to try to keep it within a three-minute limit, and I will, when it approaches that time, I may have to gently remind people, but I would hope that people would anticipate that. I would also ask that people anticipate, you've seen the agenda, anticipate your testimony, so you know, if you're far in the back of the room, if it's going to be coming your time, then maybe you could move more toward the front so we can move it along expeditiously. I believe that there's a very high probability that we will not finish our business this morning, that we'll continue then at 4:32, which is absolutely fine, and I want to have a chance for us to hear from all these good people. I also, and to the members, if there are questions for the individual, because I think given the fact we're going to continue, they may not be able to stay around, we'll be open to asking questions. I think we need to be respectful. This is not really a sort of a cross-examination time, but if there's a need for some clarification, that would certainly be in order. So we will proceed with those guidelines. We'll begin. I didn't see him, but is Glenn Dorfman here? Oh, there you are. I'm sorry. Good morning. Welcome to committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Glenn Dorfman. I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and I'm here today to ask you to consider six reasons for living within your means. First, I'm clearly not here to tell you how to spend this money, because I don't know the Health Human Services budget very well, so I would be foolish, but I trust that you will arrive at a compromise solution. So there are six reasons why we've taken the position we have this year. Minnesota working families live within their means. Not only is the cost of energy volatile right now, but it's going to settle closer into $2.50 a gallon for gas than it is $2 a gallon. In the next 6 to 12 months, economists tell us that the price of oil will move its way through the economy and affect the price of goods and services. So sometime in the next 12 months, other than the $2.50, we're going to see heating oil rise, we're going to see natural gas rise, and we're going to see food and other staples rise, which means that citizens are going to be under pressure to maintain their own households. That's number one. Number two under this issue is that Congress, as most of you know, invented the AMT years ago, and the state conformed with the alternative minimum tax in an effort to tax the rich. But as I've said here for 25 years, the rich are much smarter than most of us, and that's why they're rich. And so what ended up happening is they escape the tax because they buy tax-free municipal bonds, which we all support in this place, and they are able to hide their income. So in essence, what happened was we've caught a whole bunch of middle-income people in the AMT. Those of you that fill out your own taxes understand what I mean. You don't have to be wealthy in Minnesota to be paying $800,000 to $900,000 extra in the AMT, and we don't have the money to fix it right now. I mentioned earlier the cost of natural gas and heating oil is going to put enormous pressure on Minnesota families next winter. We are living in a globally competitive marketplace. We are still functioning in our heads as if we're in an industrial marketplace. We've never been a heavy manufacturing state, but in the future, we're going to see increasing numbers of businesses that can live, the people who work in them can live anywhere in the world, and they can just send their research to each other, particularly in the area of genomics and biotechnology. From the standpoint of our own self-serving, every, I suppose, interest group has to have something self-serving, so our self-serving issue here is clear. Independent contractor realtors and builders and developers that we represent pay all of their own health care insurance premiums. They pay both halves of Social Security. They receive no retirement or pension except what they fund for themselves each month out of the commission checks. So they're not exactly overwhelmed with let's pay more money so that other people can have better benefits than they have. And I think it's a fair position. I'm not saying that it wouldn't be nice for them to have the same deal. I'm just saying I think it's a fair position. Moving away from that, it's obvious to even the most casual observer, and I've listened to this committee on television quite a bit just to see how you're thinking about things, that if less we get control of health spending, that it, at its current rate of growth, it'll crowd out all other state spending within 15 years. And you can have the some of the folks who advocate for more spending do the math themselves. I have. And at the current rate, if nothing changes, those of us who support spending within our means or tax increases, the tax increase folks would have to raise taxes every 2 years. Because the demographics are such that the numbers of people coming into the system are going to increase as the baby boom retires. So we're in a conundrum.
We're approaching the time.
I appreciate that. I'm almost done.
Thank you.
For those who argue we should raise taxes, I respectfully ask, given the current trajectory of health care spending in Minnesota, are you willing to raise taxes every 2 years to cover the compound demographically driven increases we are sure to face as the baby boom retires over the next 25 years? And are you willing to crowd out transportation, children, early childhood education, regular education, and property tax concerns that people have here? Finally, I would argue, since the chairman would like me to get done, I would argue that tax increases take away money from privately employed. No, I'm sorry. I would argue that Minnesota is ranked 49th in poverty in the United States based on the 2003 census. We're 50th if we include the District of Columbia, according to the census. We have the 7th to 8th highest per capita income, depending upon which census you look at. And we have a total biennial budget of $53 billion. That includes the general fund, all funds, and federal funds. We have approximately 5 million people, which means we're spending in excess of $10,700 per person. If this was Mississippi, I'd understand that. This is Minnesota, and our per capita income has risen since 1995, and so has our welfare rolls. People in poverty dropped, not increased. So that's all census data. And then the last thing I would ask you to consider in your deliberation is that I was talking to a vice president of Medtronic this morning at a breakfast, and I asked him how many of his products in the last 3 years were new. And he says, well, 70% of our products in the last 2 years are new. And that's what's driving Minnesota's economy is innovation. And it's not going to be heavy labor. It's going to be brain power. So we have to fund the schools better than we're doing, and we can't fund everything else. We have to fund the schools and whatever priorities you all think are important. But everything cannot be important. So, Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate the time, and I know this is unpopular testimony, which is, I guess, why the chair asked me to do it. But I do appreciate your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Dorfman. I don't remember specifically me asking you. I think you have a right, like every citizen does, to express. I believe we have a question from Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dorfman, thanks for the statistics. I haven't had a chance to get up on the recent data lately. And since you are with the realtors, I'm curious to know what the average home in the Twin Cities, if you know that, since you have so many statistics, what that is going right now?
Oh, in excess of $220,000.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you just repeat one more time what the per capita, with the average per capita income, you said?
We're 6th and 7th in the country, someplace between 6th and 7th per capita income.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dorfman, do you know that number, though?
Well, how much it is? It's in the $45,000, $47,000 range.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Carolyn Jones? Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Carolyn Jones. I'm here representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As everyone on this committee knows, health care spending is growing at an unacceptable rate. Total health care costs are rising at a rate of nearly $300,000 per hour. According to the Citizens Forum on health care costs the average Minnesotan $11,000 for health care today, and this will double by the year 2010. Rising healthcare costs are affecting all areas of our budget and our economy. From families where insurance premiums are growing 3.5 times faster than wages over the past 4 years, which means these families have less to spend on their own individual needs, to job growth, where businesses are cutting back on investment and new hires to pay for health care costs, to state and local government, where we are seeing less money available for education, transportation, and other governmental needs. The state's health care budget is growing by 19% this year. This bill will bring that down to 15%. Even if this bill passes, Minnesota will have more generous programs than most other states. We simply have to get a handle on these costs. While there are choices in this bill that are very difficult to make, I want to compliment you, Mr. Chairman, on beginning to lay the foundation for what I hope will lead to lower trend growth in health care. If we are going to make progress on this effort, we need to address some of the underlying cost drivers in our health care system, the disconnect between the user and the provider of health care services, the absence of a system that rewards accountability and value, the lack of technology in our medical administration. The emphasis you have on this bill for evidence-based health care and paying not just for services but for value, I think will pay off in the long run. Also, the focus on moving towards more interoperable electronic records, health records, I think will save both lives and money down the road. Many of these things are long-term in nature and will not address your immediate fiscal budgetary problems. But I commend you for taking on these hard issues and beginning to lay the foundation for future reform. By taking these steps now, hopefully we will not have to make harder choices in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank
you very much. And just one question. You mentioned growing at 19% this year. Is that accurate, or is that 19% of last biennium to this biennium? So we're clear about
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beeson, you're correct.
So when most people are thinking about kind of annual rates of increase, that's not the 19% you're talking about. Just to make that clear. The other thing is, I was just wondering if you had a reaction about, I think everybody on the committee understands that there's going to be 20 to 30,000 people losing health coverage under this. How does that fit in with stopping the underlying growth of premiums in the private market?
Jones,
those are the folks you represent.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beeson, I think we will still be seeing more people on health care programs, even though kind of the rate of growth. But I think in the private sector, I think we have done things in this body and over time to try and provide some different options. I think that's one of the reasons the Minnesota Chamber has worked so diligently to try and make sure we have other options in the marketplace. I think if you look at some of the populations in this bill that may not be receiving coverage, there are possibly some better opportunities for them in the private sector. But I think it's important that we do make some changes and have something out there for them. I think there is some opportunity that they can get into the private market, which I think is what we all would like to see.
Mr. Chair, because one of my concerns with some of these cuts, and I think we've all talked about this before, is that as people don't have health coverage, it passes on to uncompensated care with the hospitals, which in turn ultimately is going to end up driving up all of our private pay premiums to cover those costs. It's just a cost shift. We're not, just because the state budget part is going down, we're not saving those costs there. And I just think that that's, and I'm assuming that that's a concern to the chamber as well, because that's those are your folks.
I think in the interest of moving on, that's a statement of opinion that you don't need necessarily respond to. You respond before. That's been a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Jones. What is in this bill that will actually affect the underlying cost drivers besides eliminating people from health care?
Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good one. I think the emphasis on trying to find value, trying to move towards a system that rewards evidence-based medicine will ultimately provide longer-term savings. I think some of the technology issues in here will, again, move us to a system that will be more efficient and provide some long-term efficiencies and savings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Jones, I am curious about what the small employers, I know the large employers, a lot of which you represent, have their own health care plans, but the small employers who don't and their employees suddenly lose their health care, what the effect is going to be on them of people that can't get can't get their health care needs taken care of, and how does that affect their ability to work and to take care of themselves and to stay healthy? Are there concerns in the chamber at all about what the impact of this is going to be on the small businesses and their ability to have healthy employees?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I think that's why I referenced some of the other options. Health savings accounts, where we see about a third of those purchasing health savings accounts never having health insurance before. The flexible benefit plan that passed the House a week or so ago is expected to encourage 8 to 10% of new employers into the marketplace. And so I think if we can continue to provide some of these more affordable options, we can begin to address some of those issues.
One final question.
One final question, Ms.
Goodman. And can you tell me what the chamber is doing to help more people get their employers get more health care, especially their smaller employers that are members of the chamber? I'm a member of the chamber in my district, and I haven't heard any discussions at all about what we can do to help the employers that are members of the chamber get health care.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I think we sort of have a three-pronged approach. I think we work at the legislature trying to provide some more affordable options. We also offer a health care plan through the Minnesota Chamber that provides some affordable options. And then we are also a member of the Smart Buy Alliance, which we think ultimately will help begin to change the marketplace in a direction that will bring that trend line down and will provide more affordable options in the marketplace. So we have kind of a three-pronged approach to trying to make healthcare more affordable in this state.
And Ms. Jones, to that point, for the last 4 or 5 years that I've been working, the chamber has been just terrific in being at the table with creative ideas. Thank you for the effort.
Very quickly, Ms. Jones, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Jones, I just wanted a clarification on, like, the first sentence you said, the average Minnesotan pays $11,000 for health care, or is that the state paying for the average Minnesotan, and is that an annual figure, Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, it is an annual figure of the average amount that Minnesotans pay, so that would include premiums, out-of-pocket, and I'd have to go back and check if, you know, government costs are included in that.
Thank you. Representative Dean, and let's make this a final so we can move on. Representative Dean?
Thank you. From the employers in my district, the one UFE is an employer in my district, 50-year company, manufacturing company that we would like to keep. Their number one cost driver is healthcare, and I learned a lot about their inflation and healthcare costs just from talking with those folks. Probably more from them than anyone else. They described the single biggest cost driver of private healthcare insurance as the government cost of healthcare. I think that's a point that we miss a lot. The cost of healthcare on the government side affecting private, particularly small employers. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's perhaps a point that is not getting through.
Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, that's Dean. I think there's probably two components of that. One is healthcare taxes, which we do see, especially through the UMCHIP assessment, which is growing rapidly, mandates that continues to impose costs on the system. There's also cost shifts between government and private payers. I think, you know, when you get to the shift issue, that's why it's so important that if we are going to do anything on healthcare costs, we really need to get at underlying factors. We can't just continue to play a shell game with costs, and that's why I think some of the attention that this bill does give and in other efforts by the chairman to address some of these underlying cost factors, that really is where we're going to make some progress on health care.
I have a couple of really short ones. Representative Tremba, and then Representative Huntley, and then we'll move on.
In the largest community in and around my district, 10 years ago, every single one of the chamber offered health insurance. This year, the number was down to only 38%. That's really concerning to all of us in the community. And basically, they say it's the cost of insurance premiums. And how I understand some of the things you're saying and that are future pieces, but the crisis is right now, and it's dropping, you know, as I talk. And so it's easy to say, well, this is great now, but how do we, how can the chamber help us have that bridge from losing their health care as a business? And a lot of those then, therefore, in some cases, were on Minnesota Care. How do we bridge that by just not totally dropping them all? And in this case, it's a county hospital, so they're going to go there and it's going to be uncompensated care. And then those of us who live in that area, including the business people, are going to pay higher property taxes. So what kind of ideas does the chamber have to build that bridge? Because ultimately this is going to cost those businesses a lot of money in increases in property taxes.
Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, I probably said it before, but yeah. I think you need some options. You can't have just the Cadillac available to these small businesses. They can't afford the Cadillac, and if they had something other than that, then it wouldn't be a choice between just dropping coverage and or offering, offering something or offering nothing.
And I think that we are on the verge also, Representative Tremba, of the alliances. The work with the Employers Association is almost here now as another avenue, and there's many of the businesses you're talking about waiting anxiously to be able to jump onto that when we get the final signature of the reinsurance.
Just one more comment on that. And I see that happening, and I see the large deductibles. And I think you've heard my example before. A family took the highest deductible because that was all the premium that they could afford. They had a baby. The baby was $10,000, so there was a $5,000 deductible plus an 80-20. That's $6,500. And the baby got sick. And because their entire bill wasn't paid, that clinic absolutely would not see that baby. And that's what's happening. These policies sound great. But for a lot of people who are on the lower rung of an employee, it doesn't help. They end up not being able to go to the doctor because there are private clinics that are insisting that they pay 10% of the bill. I don't know how many of us could afford not only a premium, but $650 a month to pay for their... So that it's a catch-22 in a lot of cases, and so this whole business of health savings accounts or higher deductibles is great for the employer, but what about that employee who, when one of the family members gets sick, they get turned around, and then the clinic tells them, well, go to the hospital, go to the emergency room, another uncompensated care, but it's in a new year, and so then again they have the $5,000 deductible again, and it starts all over again, and that's happening. I've had three cases in this year already of people that have called me about that kind of thing. So it sounds great, and it's great for the employer, but I think we have to look at some of the effects that it's going to have on the employees also, because it isn't the dream world that it's portrayed to be.
Just remind members, we're here to listen to the public by and large, and we're beginning to have more testimony from our members than we are from the public. Let's try to keep it a little bit to clarification and so forth. Representative Huntley, you said you had a brief one.
Well, just for Representative Dean, you ought to look at this bill and what it does to hospitals. In effect, if this bill were to pass, hospitals will be paid for medical assistance patients 25% less than their cost, and that's over a 6-year period. Every penny of that underpayment to hospitals is transferred to businesses buying health insurance for their employees, every single penny.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Huntley. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Jones. Jeff Bankford? Mr. Bangford, welcome back to the committee. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bangford. I work for the Minnesota Home Care Association, and I'm also a member of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. I know you've had many, many tough decisions to make. There's been a lot of issues in this bill that have been deliberated, and I want you to know there are two major issues we need to hear about today. One has to do with the 2% rate increase for all home and community-based services, including nursing homes. This is a very important particular piece of legislation for us and the home care community, and we need it desperately to fund, to pay for direct care staff workers that are working on the front lines, as well as to help the industries that are hurting very much, that are trying to help people that are living in their homes. Without this particular increase, we would be very strapped this year to see our workers continue to stay in the places of employment and work in their homes. And we thank you very much for allowing that 2% increase to come for this year and for next year. Second, I want to speak specifically to House File 1574, Representative Shara Samuelson's bill, and Chairman Bradley, I thank you for your positive words that you made yesterday in regards to this bill. It wasn't fully funded. It was a percentage of the funding, but it gets us in the right direction, and we really appreciate the recognition that you have with the amount of money that is necessary to pay for the professional staff that are in home care. We do see home care as a solution to reduce costs outside of the home and to prevent hospitalizations, to prevent emergency room visits in the future. And so we do believe that this is an investment in the future for people in long-term care needs, also with post-acute care needs, to receive health care in their homes, and to also help the industries with telehome care and other types of mechanisms that are necessary for people to continue to stay in their homes as well. Thank you very much, and that's all I have to say, unless you have any questions.
Mr. Bangford, just let me add to your good feeling, because in fact, if you look at the total bill, and I know it can be a little confusing, but in fact, the COLA is even more than the 2%. It probably is going to be 2.2 or 2.3, because we have an additional COLA with some of the money that we recycle back. So I know it sometimes can be easily missed, but I'm really happy that this committee is able to bring that forward, and thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I haven't received a spreadsheet. I just got the bill this morning, which I have a lot of reading to do.
Take a good look at that. And I haven't figured out exactly, Mr. Mangsberg, what that additional is going to do, but it should be in the range of at least a couple tenths percent more than the two.
Okay.
So good news.
Thank you again.
Thank you for your testimony. Patty Cohen? Patty Cohen and Don Houston. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Good to see you again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm John Husted, Vice President of Public Affairs at the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance.
And I'm Patty Cohen with Care Providers in Minnesota. He's always with me.
Yes, I'm the doctor. Mr. Chair, I'll begin and then turn it over to Ms. Cohen to finish up. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, at the beginning of this session, you held a press conference and made a commitment to make every effort to provide and find money for a cost of living increase for the continuum of long-term care providers. And I want to say that there's a sigh of relief and thanks across Minnesota among long-term care providers that you were able to meet that challenge and meet that commitment and provide a 2% plus per year COLA for the whole continuum of providers. We thank you very much for living up to that commitment. I would say that you, the committee here, you and long-term care providers actually have something in common. For the last 2 years, because of the freeze and some cuts, long-term care providers have had to live within their means and meet the challenge of caring for older adults despite rising costs of food and fuel and insurance and all sorts of things. And they've done that, and I congratulate them on that. And you, too, have to live within your means. You have a great challenge and a lot of needs in health and human services and yet limited resources. And we very much appreciate you making every effort to find money to meet this really important need, and we thank you very much. The other issue I'd like to bring up briefly is transformation. This bill came late to you in the session. I'm referring to House File 1967, and we appreciate you giving that bill a hearing and beginning the discussion on what to do about the aging infrastructure of nursing homes and also about choices in our communities so that our elders will be able to stay in their homes for as long as possible and stay in their community to receive services. I think the bill was a good foundation to begin that discussion, and we very much look forward to working with you in the interim leading into next session to try to address that important issue as well.
I'm going to cover a few of the provisions that may not be covered by a few of the other testifiers that are on the long list behind us that we want to make sure you understand how positive they are and how we think there's going to be a ripple effect. Little measures that we think down the way could really change the face of long-term care in the future. Representative Abler's bill on the Long-Term Care Partnership Program, I think this is the fourth year that a version of this bill has come forward, and it's in there, and I think it might work. And I think it will make a difference in the area of personal responsibility down the way and the purchasing of long-term care insurance and the financial advisor community, of which I've had many conversations with, are looking carefully at this provision to make sure that it becomes reality. There's a provision in here from Representative Pawlowski authorizing our state to move ahead with the PACE program. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about the potential benefits of this type of pilot project on the seniors in communities that are really heavier care, high risk, currently nursing home folks being served in other settings. And it's a pilot that has been had fantastic outcomes in some other states. With this going forward, I think we're going to be able to look in a few years at some really fascinating models of different delivery services. The bill that provides home care increases also is of concern, and we're very pleased with all of the changes providing enhanced reimbursement for home care in this bill. Again, we represent the continuum, so we're not just the nursing home provider group here. We also didn't get a chance to really comment on Representative Wilkins' bill 980, where there's some really positive provisions to take a thoughtful look at the younger population in nursing homes. Our members who serve the under 65 population would concur with all of the comments here. Perhaps not in the negative fashion some of them are made, but we concur that that's not really the place that people want to be. If you're 50 years old, you don't want to be in a nursing home where the average age is 86, 87. So the planful approach that this bill does in that area we think is fantastic. We do think there'll be a ripple effect as well in that type of population and who is served. One of the reasons why we think it's important to look at appropriate levels of service is down the way we also believe there will be further beds closed in nursing homes so that the beds that remain are the ones that should be designed for those that need the most intensive care, the intensive needs. Finally, there is a proposal in the bill to establish a new payment system for nursing facilities. And the language in the omnibus bill looks rather dramatically different from the language that you saw in the initial House File 1422. Let me just say, we have been working very hard over the last few weeks, months, years, but really the last few weeks, to come up with an alternative system that is fair, that meets state public policy goals such as tying quality and reimbursement together, making sure we don't create access difficulties to the continuing services, and at the same time making sure there's some fiscal responsibility. Much of the language in Article 4 for the new payment system reflects that hard work. And great kudos to Representative Bradley for, it's kind of a love-hate relationship, and he said, we're going to move forward, work hard. I said, what? But we really did work hard, and I think sometimes you have to be forced to the line before you can really work on putting some stuff together. We do have a few concerns, and we're hoping that we can address those concerns as we move ahead in the process. We, Representative Bradley and us have had a few conversations about the issue of staffing levels and how you can figure out how the appropriate levels of staff should be recognized in facilities, and that's still kind of an issue out there. And there was also some new language in there relating to how the hold harmless works that we have a little bit of a concern about, only because when the COLA is applied to across the long-term care continuum, it's a real small world. Everyone talks to everyone else and knows what percentage is given and how it's given, and if it's not given right, you'll probably hear from folks and others will hear from folks. But the interaction with the hold harmless in the payment system and the second year of the COLA may result in some facilities not getting that 2% available for employees. So I think that's just another area that, again, we just read the language yesterday, so there may be an opportunity to talk it through and figure out if there can be some fixes here. But having said those, I want to end on a high note because I understand how difficult with all of the competing, having read through the bill for the third time last night, how difficult the decisions were and how many funding priorities, I don't even know the total dollar number of the bills that came before you, but there was a substantial amount. And the fact that setting the cost of living adjustment for our workers and our facilities as a top priority, as well as an investment in a new payment system. We want to be able to make sure you understand. We are very appreciative, and our members will be as well.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We are, I think, in an evolutionary. Now, I appreciate you've been kind to me because my nudge was intended to be kind and gentle but firm.
Yeah.
And I think it was the right thing to do. But I would admit there's probably some holes with this last minute. I don't know that we handled the hold harmless and the staffing. I mean, I fully support the notions. The problem I had was it sort of was an automatic in the forecast, and I have some concerns about that. I'm not sure we did it exactly right. Since it's only 10% of the consideration in the second year, it's a fairly small. Maybe as you begin to get runs, there will be some differences probably, and there will probably be some individual nursing homes. However, we've had disparities too amongst nursing home rates that are not very explainable. And I think part of the design of the restructure is to try to ease our way out of those disparities. So this is a tricky and it's very complicated, and I appreciate the work that went on between you and the department. Representative Goodman.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and for either one of you. I see in the bill that there's a 2% increase for staff each year, but it is offset by whatever the employer has paid in Medicare taxes, workers' compensation premiums, and federal and state unemployment insurance. So two-thirds of that 2% is supposed to go to salaries, two-thirds of that 2%. But then it's offset by any increase that the homes and in-home health providers and ICFMRs can reduce that staff increase by whatever they spent in the last 2 years for those things, including things the employer is responsible for, like workers' comp premiums, federal and state unemployment insurance. So actually, how much of an increase do you expect that the employees, and I know it'll vary across the board, but how much of an increase do you expect that the employees will actually get out of this funding?
Mr. Yusuf?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Goodwin, there are kind of two questions really there. One is about using the COLA for wages and benefits or compensation, and that includes those other costs you were talking about. The two-thirds of the COLA is devoted to those costs. And then the question of going back to 2003, the language, going back to 2003 is particularly important for the hospital attached facilities, many, almost all of whom have already given wage increases and always have to and have actually used some of their money from the hospitals to do so. They, because they employ both hospital and nursing home employees, they usually have to keep those wages and benefits pretty comparable. And after giving their wage increase previously, if they did that again, and they may, they have to balance off then what it costs to provide the increase to hospital workers. So that language in there is just an attempt to not penalize them for giving previous increases. There's the other part of that question, too, about compensation costs. And employees do benefit from health insurance and other insurance costs, and that's always, I think, the last couple of years been a part of what's allowed under the COLA wages.
Mr. Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Husted, I know that a number of people that work in nursing homes and in-home care services are on Minnesota Care right now, and they their facilities, their providers don't provide health insurance for them. And I also know that they're exposed to a number of diseases and so forth in their work, and they're very low-paid workers, and they don't have health insurance. Well, how do you feel about the cuts to Minnesota Care? How is that going to affect the ability for them to take care of people in the homes?
I always like to let Patty share in the answers to these questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, we don't know how many of our... We've been asked the question, how many of our employees are on Minnesota Care? We don't know that for a fact, because you can't ask whether or not they have health coverage when they're an employee of your facility. That's private information. We surmise there is a percentage, but we also know that most of the folks in our facility actually wouldn't be in the category of folks that are being deemed ineligible for Minnesota Care. Most of them are working mothers with kids. Some of them have coverage through their spouses, and that's why they don't pay the high, relatively high health insurance coverage that we have in our facilities. So we haven't done the information to know, does any of the Minnesota care changes affect our employees or not?
Mr. Chair.
Trustee Goodman, wrap it up so we can move on, please.
I can tell you that in my district, a lot of people that do in-home care, because I have a lot of elderly in my district, and a lot of people that work in nursing homes do not have health coverage, and they are on Minnesota Care, and they have contacted me about the cuts to Minnesota Care. So, just want you to know that.
Mr. Chair, and either person there, do you know how many of the nurses' aides, what percentage are offered health insurance in your industry?
Ms. Cohen?
Representative Huntley, the last time we had done a study on this was probably in 2003, and the offering of the health insurance was relatively high, but the take-up rate was relatively low, and the reason is the family coverage. The most interest in the family coverage, and the premiums for family coverage were, you know, in excess of $400, $500 a month, which is prohibitive on their salary. So we do have, the vast majority of the folks that have the take-up rate for our health insurance are not at the nurse aid level because they were primarily interested at the in the family coverage.
What is the percentage that are offered insurance?
Ms. Cohen?
Representative Huntley, I can get you the details from our study in 03, but I know it was over 70% in 2003.
Well, Mr. Chair, if they're offered insurance, they're not eligible whether or not they can afford it for Minnesota Care. But it sounds like about 30% are not even offered insurance and would be eligible for Minnesota Care until the cuts we made 2 years ago.
Well, Representative, they wouldn't be true necessarily for the children depending upon their income.
Well, if they're single adults working, I can tell you one that I know, Kathleen, I've talked about her many times, a health care provider. She was on Minnesota Care.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next we have Patrick Umblatt, and I probably messed that up, and you can introduce yourself and straighten me out. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Close enough. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Obrimt. I'm here as a pharmacist and a member of the Minnesota Pharmacies Association and on behalf of the Minnesota Retailers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to let me testify this morning. I know there's a lot of people, I can see on the agenda, a lot of people waiting to testify, so I'll be brief. I'm here today to express our appreciation for the inclusion of Representative Abler's Medication Therapy Management Services bill and Representative Finstad's Rural Pharmacy Preservation Act in the omnibus bill. I believe that these two initiatives will ensure that pharmacists remain accessible and that they use their abilities to provide the best assistance to Medicaid patients and patients in getting the most from their medications and achieving better health care outcomes, and also making the most of Minnesota Medicaid dollars. I also want to express our appreciation for the efforts to reduce the Medicare, the proposed cuts in Governor Pawlenty's proposal in pharmacy reimbursement cuts. While the reimbursement is going from, in the current bill, from AWP minus 11.5 to AWP minus 12, while some impact, it is not as devastating as the proposed AWP minus 14 would have been for Minnesota pharmacies. I recognize the severity of I would like to thank all the committee members and especially Chairman Bradley for recognizing the severity of the cuts originally proposed and for doing what was possible to reduce the impact. I appreciate your time this morning and thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Bruce Nelson?
Thank you,
welcome
Mr.
again
Chair.
To the committee.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair?
Welcome again to the
thank
committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Bruce Nelson of ARM. We're an association of about 150 providers who provide services in ICFMR, the various waivered services, and our members employ about 25,000 direct support professionals across Minnesota. And On behalf of those people, I want to thank you for many of the provisions in the bill. And I do know that many of the decisions that are in front of you and you'll be deliberating are very tough ones. But I want to tell you that a number of provisions in the bill do mean a lot to the people who work in this industry. First, the COLA. It means a lot to direct support professionals who've seen their hours cut, they've seen their overall compensation go down, and the COLA provided in the bill will mean that they'll be able to hold on to the benefits and very likely, and for sure, be able to get a small but a very meaningful increase in their paychecks. It means a lot, the COLA, to people with disabilities who've seen the quality of life begin to diminish in the last few years and their ability to get into the community and be able to hold on to that quality of life. And more importantly, to make sure that we're able to provide the health and the safety and welfare protections for them in the various homes and services across Minnesota. And it means a lot to the providers we represent in ARM. They've had to make some Sophie's choices in the last few years. In the last two or three years, do we cut people? Yes, they have had to cut people. Have they cut hours that have an impact on people with disabilities? Yes, they've had to do that. And because of the rising costs, particularly in insurance area, they've had to cut their insurance insurances or make them ask people to pay more in co-pays, more in their share of insurance, and as a result have suffered an overall decrease in their compensation. It's been a tough choice for providers, and Ms. Cole will help a lot. The second issue is the ICFMR shift to counties and the plan that's put forward for defining the future of ICFMR. The shift that went into effect 2 years ago has been reduced, and we thank you, by 75%. We think that it will take the pressure off. But we've seen, and it meaning a lot to people with disabilities who, without this, would be evicted, essentially, from the homes. Many of them have lived in these homes for 20, 25 years. More importantly, perhaps, is the plan that will roll forward as a result of the provision in the bill to provide stability in the system and ensure choice for people and their families of where they live and where they will receive services. There's a provision in the bill around CDCS, community... I'm blanking out on what CDCS means. It means a lot, what you put in there, Chairman Bradley. The people with disabilities, many with profound medical needs, and they'll, as a result of this, be able to hold on to the services they now have. So we appreciate that. Provisions in the bill around quality assurance and the Region 10 program down in southeast Minnesota. It means a lot to the people with disabilities down there and the providers as well in order to have their services centered around what they need and what they want. And perhaps even more importantly, to begin the first steps to taking this wonderful effort statewide so that in the future, hopefully, more and more of our services that we provide are directed by the consumers themselves. And
excuse me, Mr. Nelson, as much as I'm appreciating what you're saying, we're pushed on time here, okay, a little bit, so if you could come close to wrapping up, please.
Other folks will speak on Representative Wilkins' bill. We appreciate many of the provisions there. And I just wanted to thank you for the many provisions in the bill that address the quality of life, health, and safety of people with disabilities, vulnerable citizens across Minnesota, and we are very grateful for those. Thank you
very much for your testimony. Okay.
Well, what's that, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any concerns you have with the bill?
Mr. Chair, now Representative Thiessen, we're concerned that there are, in these times of fiscal woe, if you will, that you're going to have to make some very difficult decisions. And I have never advocated to take money from another entity to provide services for the people I represent, and I never have and I never will. That is your job. All I can do is tell you the impact of what you do or don't do on the people I represent. I wish there were the coffers were richer and you didn't have to make those very difficult decisions. I wish they didn't have to happen. I think everybody in this room does. So that would be my concern.
Well, and Mr. Chair, just a comment. I mean, everybody so far has talked about that these decisions are being forced upon us, that these cuts of all these people off healthcare being forced upon us, and that's not really true, and I think we just need to get that out on the table. We did have other choices. We're just not allowed to talk about that.
Thanks for your testimony, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
That's not good, but do you have testimony?
I have question.
Okay, question.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, you were a staff here at the house when Minnesota Care was put together, correct? You helped put the program together.
Yes, I was.
You were instrumental, in fact, in Minnesota question. Care. And Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, what percentage of the people of the staff that you represent receive health care or are on Minnesota Care? First two questions, how many receive private health insurance from the employer? And the second question is, do you know how many are currently getting general assistance medical care or Minnesota Care or a program like that?
Chair, Representative Goodwin, I don't know the precise pickup on insurance in our industry. When you were asking the question earlier, I was looking for someone in the room from our association who might have a better handle on that. I presume it's around 50%. Many of the people who work in our industry work for various agencies and work part-time. And those people who do work part-time, I presume, although we don't have those figures, I presume are on Minnesota Care. And I would presume that some of them, in fact, would likely lose their benefits. Most, I guess, and I'll try to get back with more precise numbers, I guess are single moms with kids.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Nelson, we haven't done anything to family kinds of things, so I'm not sure what would be changing there. But good one.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, I think this is a hard position for you to be in, and I think it's unfortunate because I know how much work and how many years you put into putting together the Minnesota Care Plan, and you did an excellent job, and it must be hard to see the program basically gutted like it's being done.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nelson, as one of those former staff and former nominated individuals for ARM, I do understand personally the struggles that you're having right now, testifying on behalf of the many individuals that depend on you. I'm actually, Representative Goodwin asked the questions that I was interested in. If there's a way, and it's not necessarily in the next couple weeks, I'd be okay in the next session, trying to figure out how many of the workers. I know when I've worked full-time and part-time in different group homes, and even when I was full-time as a single mom, I wasn't able to afford the insurance myself, and that was before. That was in 94, 95, and 96 when health care was a lot cheaper, and we were still getting our raises. And so if there's a way that we can figure out what staff are getting, who's getting private, if there are individuals that are going on to government to figure out if that's the next level that we need to be tackling after dealing with the COLA, I'd appreciate that.
And Mr. Nelson, if you have some of that information, if you could give that to our staff, and we'll make sure we give it to the committee.
And I'd be happy to work with you on that, and we are in the process of developing that. If I could add, Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, that it is not a struggle for me to, on behalf of people with disabilities, on behalf of the direct support professionals, to applaud the work done in this bill. My personal feelings, there's a lot of things I think everybody wish we could do more of, and as a citizen of Minnesota, but on behalf of those folks, I am eternally grateful for what's in the bill.
Mr. Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, I'll stand corrected. I will say, though, just briefly, because I know we have so many folks that I've talked to many of those individuals, and although they're happy with the COLA, they understand the difficulties that they're going to be having as single adults moving forward with the other parts of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you again for your testimony.
I look forward to working for
you. Grace Petrie? Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today about House File 1422. My name is Grace Petrie from Virginia, Minnesota, and I'm here today representing AARP Minnesota. AARP is appreciative of the provisions in this budget to provide cost of living increases for long-term care workers. We strongly believe that increasing staffing is the best way to ensure quality care for our most vulnerable citizens, nursing home residents. We also support the inclusion of Governor Pawlenty's new value-based nursing home reimbursement system that rewards facilities based on quality care. However, we hope that the work group of stakeholders can continue to work with legislators to make sure that this proposal provides the adequate incentives for quality care, particularly staffing. We also strongly urge that the committee reject the proposed $31 million cut in the Alternative Care Program. The Alternative Care Program is a cost-effective state program that allows older and disabled people in need of care to remain in their own homes, avoiding costly nursing home stays. Reducing the time spent in nursing homes significantly lowers the cost for both the state and the individual. The average cost of a monthly nursing home stay is $4,000, while the Alternative Care Program costs $1,000. Retaining the ability to stay at home also creates a better quality of life by giving older and disabled people more dignity and independence. New restrictions on eligibility for the Alternative Care Program passed in 2003 have already deterred many people in need of care from participating in the program. Now this proposed cut, combined with those recent restrictions, will prevent even more Minnesotans from obtaining the cost-effective care. It makes common sense to maintain the Alternative Care Program at the current level. On behalf of AARP, I urge that you reject the proposed cuts in this vital program. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Petrie. On that, and you know, I can't say that any of these are easy, but are you aware in the alternative care of what the criteria are for at risk of going to nursing home, how long that's supposed to be?
It was 180 days, and I believe the proposal is for 120 days.
Yeah, and just for your thought, because I'm not trying to trick or anything, but one of the reasons that we did this, or the prime reason we did this, was more of a reform, because what we're finding is that the average is significantly longer than that. And we believe, frankly, by making a modest change, that maybe we'll bring it more into that 180 days, because it is a front-end judgment. But I appreciate what you're saying. I just wanted you to understand there was some logic in what we were trying to do. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Petrie, I know AARP's legislative agenda is. I'm curious to know, are you familiar with the amount of members that you have that are raising their grandchildren?
I don't have the answer to that right now, but we can get that answer for you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be curious in knowing that one of the provisions in the bill is looks like something small, but actually impacts relatives, grandparents quite a bit, that Representative Bradley is moving forward. And if you are 175% above poverty as a grandmother raising three children, you may have more difficulties qualifying for Minnesota care, so I'd appreciate that information.
Okay, we'll get that to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Jim Boston? Good morning. Welcome. Good to see you again. We have more than one.
Good morning.
This is probably Jane, and I can't say Jane O. Can I get
by? Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Jim Vossen, and I'm with USCW Local 653 representing nursing home workers. With me is Jane Okramovich, a volunteer with the Alzheimer's Association. Together we are speaking on behalf of Seniors and Workers for Quality. We'll comment on two portions of Article 4, the cost of living adjustments in the proposed new nursing home reimbursement system, of which Jane and I have both been members of that negotiating group. We appreciate the 2% rate increases in each of the coming 2 years, but for the whole spectrum of facilities and services in long-term care. The recommendation we have is in the policy language with no additional cost. The rate increases are such limited and precious money that we believe it is crucial that dollars be targeted, that priorities be made. Therefore, where Article 4, Section 6 would pass two-thirds of the new money through to any employees, we would respectfully ask that the two-thirds be for non-administrative employees. We recognize that the rate freezes of recent years have affected all, but where dollars are few, let us act in the interest of the lowest paid, largely hands-on staff. On a similar note, we recommend deleting subsection B of sections in Section 6, the provision that would allow new money to be used for increases that occurred since July 1, 2003. Together, the general term employee plus retroactivity may mean that direct care workers in a facility or service will receive no salary, nor new salary or benefit when October 2005 begins.
Mr. Chair, again, I'm Jane Okramovich, and I am a volunteer, and I'm also the board chair of Minutes of the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota, North Dakota. Not long ago, we testified, both Jim and I, on this bill as introduced, and we voiced our support for the direction of new nursing home reimbursement system, particularly one that fundamentally aimed at rewarding staffing and quality care. At that time, we mentioned the hundreds of hours that we have invested in the stakeholder meetings to create this new system. I must add that it seems like we've had 100 more hours since that last few weeks. In Article 4, Section 21, there is a milestone in achieving the new system. However, we are distressed and we are very unhappy to see the elimination of funds that was recommended by the governor in his budget for staffing to complement the launch of this new method of setting nursing home rates, mm-hmm. roughly about $19 million, and that was to be effective October 1st of 2007. The reason for this is it truly breaks my heart to see staff who not only cannot do the extra niceties, like chatting with a lonely resident for a while, but they are running themselves ragged with the essentials, like getting people to the bathroom on time to protect them from embarrassment. And that's the people picture part of this. I brought along a bibliography of literature on the positive relationship between staffing and quality care in long-term care and quality, compiled by one of the nation's experts in nursing home reimbursement. Let's start this new reimbursement system in a way that enhances the facility's opportunities to succeed by including funding to improve staffing. Thank you very much for this opportunity to voice our concerns.
Well, thank you, and I do want to congratulate you. I know it must seem like an eternity that there's been a team's working on this restructuring work. Thank you for participation. Just to make sure, though, a couple of clarifications. One I mentioned before, and maybe I'll get exact numbers so we can all start talking about the core. That's 2 point something, because it is a little more.
I appreciate that.
The other one that you mentioned, and I struggle with it too, because I fully support the notion of staffing you're talking about. What I was caught with is trying to have fairness between group homes and ICFMRs and others, and trying to really balance. I mean, we put a significant amount of extra money by putting an additional 2% in the nursing home world in the second year of the biennium. I didn't think it was fair for the nursing homes, in addition to that plus 2%, to be getting an additional increase that was part of the original governor's. So I was trying to balance, and it was a struggle. I wish there had been kind of a way to sort of better integrate, and it was kind of be the last minute, but it was really, really hard to sort of figure out. So that's the logic. I'm not at all disagreeing about having something. The problem was that if we left it with the original governor's proposal per se, we'd have been putting an additional increase on top of it, and how would I tell my friends in ICFMRs and group homes and those kinds of things. So it was just a struggle to try to balance between the continuum of long-term continuing care. So I think as we come back in the future to this, when actually that part takes more of an effect on the settlements, because it's only about 10% in that second year that's actually used from that formula. I'm sympathetic. We just couldn't figure out a way quickly to make that work. Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Vossen?
Yes.
Can you tell me, I assume that a lot of the people you represent would have health insurance because you'd negotiate that for them.
Mm-hmm.
But
I'm sure also that you don't represent all of the nursing homes in the state. What percentage do you represent, do you think?
Personally, I have a small percentage of the nursing homes in the state, but as a whole, the unions represent approximately 30% of the industry. The UFCW and SEIU together probably have equal numbers and are the two largest representatives of nursing home workers in the state. And there are a large number of those people that are without insurance. There are a large number that are in MnCare. We have, along with the AFL-CIO, supported a bill that we hope continues to move, that Representative Thiessen has talked about, where we're looking to get a report on where are the people coming from that are enrolled in MnCare so that we can figure out where we need to work on it. Now, I'm not faulting our industry for what they have for insurance, because a lot of it is the system in which it was developed, and we have to correct that. And we floated a bill in the Senate to start looking at that, and are trying to continue to move that dialogue to figure out a better way to get better comprehensive insurance in the long-term care system. But I think it's important that we do get a handle on where are the people that are in MnCare, as more and more states are reporting that out, to figure out where it is so that we can look at what issues need to be addressed.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Boston. I'm also curious about this 2% increase that is offset by the amount of money that they might have spent on workers' comp, unemployment comp, and Medicare tax, and FICA, and so forth, not only for the next 2 years, but for the past 2 years. What do you think what would your guess be that would be left actually for increases to health care workers?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Goodwin, actually I couldn't guess that, but the reality is that if you don't, in my opinion, I believe that we need to do it as future spending. And that's what we're asking for with the proposal we've adjusted, is that it should be for future spending from July 1st. From October 1st.
To that point, Mr. Boston,
yes,
do you have any sympathy, though, for the case of an attached hospital where kind of collectively an increase was very recently given, sort of taking the risk that should somehow be taken into account?
I understand that, and I think that as a group, as we talked in negotiations, on the negotiating, we have separated out the different groups into peer groups, so that we could deal with the individual issues sometimes that may come up within those peer groups. And so it is an issue that I'm hoping that we can come back and continue that dialogue within that group of negotiators, so that we can look at that specific area if it's a concern and figure out what can be done. But I think that, in my opinion, it would be a difficulty to use that one group as kind of a penalty to the rest of the system to utilize and allow for the retroactivity to be considered for the entirety of the groups.
And with your wise advice, maybe we can take a shot at that and look at for something between. I'd certainly be open to try to work with you on that.
Thank you.
Representative Goodman?
That's all.
Okay, thank you. Representative Deacon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, some good points were made here as far as the increase is not actually being a 2% because of being able to include pay and benefits from previous years. And I was just wondering if this increase is really going to have much of an impact on the loss of staffing, the difficulty in finding staff in the nursing homes. That's a real difficulty. I know in our area we're having a real problem trying to keep staffing because the pay has been frozen for the last 3 years. I mean, will this do anything to stop that? Or?
Well, it certainly won't do anything to hurt it, Mr. Chair and Representative Econ. And I think that we believe and we thank you that there's money there, and we do believe that it has to be there, because I can tell you that I have long-term people that have talked about maybe it's time to get out. And I think that we deal with turnover issues and we deal with retention, and I think it's getting more and more difficult. As I visit in labor management meetings and I deal with negotiations, that it gets more and more difficult, and I appreciate the fact that we do have money here. I've addressed the concern we have with how the money should be spent, but it certainly won't hurt, and it hopefully will be helpful.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mark McAbee? Good morning. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm Mark McAfee with AFSCME Council 5. Item number one, Article 2, Section 5 of the bill gives the Commissioner of DHS carte blanche authority to close regional treatment center programs and campuses. The legislature, we feel, needs to receive, carefully consider, and legislatively approve any such plans. Therefore, we would suggest that you delete this section of the bill. Item number two, we share with many of the folks that are coming before the committee an overall concern about the cuts to Minnesota Care and pushing more low-income working families off insurance. And yes, we do have some of the state employees that are part-time are on Minnesota Care. We have people that work within Minnesota Care as well. We do have a concern about that. Item three that goes along with this, the 5% rate cut to hospitals, which, as was mentioned yesterday with the federal cuts, is well over $100 million hit to some of these hospitals. It will come at a time when people will be coming off Minnesota Care, more showing up at emergency rooms after being dropped. And that's a major concern. Others have talked about the nursing home rate increases. We do represent some folks in nursing homes. We appreciate that this is a step in the right direction. Others have talked about the how much of the increase will go to workers, but we'll continue in this area. We appreciate the effort to do something there. Unfortunately, it comes at the expense of others' programs like Minnesota Care, et cetera. So many of us coming for you today feel a bit like we're part of the Donner Party. We hope we're rescued, and we face sometimes the unthinkable. Finally, item five, how can we escape this desert of shrinking pools of revenue? First of all, within the purview of your group, you can look at professional technical contracts, as Representative Goodwin mentioned yesterday. After all, DHS or health or other groups will be looking at those in the future, and they do spend considerable amounts of money. And finally, of course, we may have a philosophical difference, Mr. Chairman. We do think you have the option of looking at adjusting revenues. We appreciate you have to deal within this target, but we do not share the view that we are constrained by our current situation. We think a growing number of people will feel that health care for all is more important than no new taxes. With that, I'll stop and try to answer any questions and appreciate again the opportunity.
I appreciate your testimony. Just a sort of a comment to the question about revenues. There is more to this than just having to make some tough decisions for trade-offs. It is also a matter, as I've said repeatedly, that unfortunately our budget as a whole, even with the changes that are here, is still increasing at more than 7.5% a year. And if we don't get our arms around it, there's no tax policy in the world that can keep up with that. I think Mr. Dorfman said that earlier on. So there is a practical challenge that is beyond the question of whether or not a person is willing to raise some additional revenue.
But Mr. Chair, and members, we understand and appreciate that, and obviously somehow getting good long-term health care and wrestling with those decisions are important. But also, we know that, for example, with Minnesota Care cuts, et cetera, that I would think the first two testifiers, they must be concerned about whether they will have customers for the houses they're selling or for the small businesses they represent. So this is Mr. Chair, you've wrestled and the members wrestled with what you're given. And I know you work long and hard and take a number of ideas, but I think many of us feel we're at the point, and I think there's beginning to be some business people added to us, that we're at the point that we do need to look at the whole economic development and tax picture, and healthcare comes in as a significant part within it. So you're feeling the constraints, and we appreciate the growth, but
sure.
Thank you.
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McAfee, thank you for coming to share some. Yeah, once in a while we find something we agree on. But you mentioned that we should be doing a tax increase. All that's been proposed this year, at the most, was the Dorman-Grilling Amendment, which was $358 million. Now, in this committee, it was suggested that we do, my guesstimate is about $300 million more in spending by the minority caucus. So that would take the vast majority of that. Now, I'm also on the Jobs Finance Committee, and they've been suggesting similar things, although there hasn't been a specific dollar amount. I'm not on K-12. I'm not on state government finance. I'm not on environment. I'm not on ag finance, transportation finance. How many times can you use a dollar? My assumption is fiscal analysts will only let us use it once. Would you rather, if we had those $358 million, that we used it all here? Or might you have some interest in state government finance and some of the other areas?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, I guess I would be so bold as to say a philosophical difference. I don't feel constrained by the $350 million. We may need more than that. And again, I appreciate others from the other side of the aisle, whatever, may need to come forward with a plan to have other options in terms of taxation. As we've visited over the last few years with members on both sides of the aisle, a number of people have said they'd be willing to do a blink on, blink off on income tax or whatever. The governor obviously feels very strongly, but nonetheless, we feel, and we understand, I mean, you're saying if we're constrained by $350 million, or we're constrained by we have no new taxes or whatever, again, it takes real thought. No one wants a long-term major tax increase, but I think those that have lost their jobs, lost their health care, and then come back onto it are usually really glad to be able to pay taxes, and it's a matter of working through and seeing what's fair and seeing what works for the long-term good of this state, because I would agree we can't continue to borrow and shift our way through these issues or problems. So we'll either close down programs and have people fend for themselves, or we'll decide how we assess fairly to pay for them. And we can always question how the money is spent. I certainly won't disagree with that, to contain health care costs where we can.
We're beginning to get a little afield, and I think this is a good discussion, but I think we ought to begin to move on. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, there's one thing that Mr. McAfee said that I think is important that we reemphasize, and that is that health care is one piece of our economic development picture, and it really is an investment that we make in people. If they're not having to worry about getting their health care, then they can worry about moving up the job ladder, getting improved skills, and not falling away from work, which is the direction that we're pushing people, which is to leave their jobs. And so I thank him for raising that point.
Thank you for your testimony.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question for him, too.
No, I was actually looking at Mark this time.
Mr. McAfee, I have a question for you.
I'm going to check to see if there's some people that are from out of town. We have a session at noon, and I want to respect if there are some people that would find it extremely difficult to come back at 4:30. So after we complete this, I'll check on that. Mr. McAfee?
I was working till about 2 o'clock in the morning adding up all the contracts, the consultant contracts that the Department of Human Services has entered into, and I stopped at over $100 million because I couldn't see anymore, but that was, I had at least 6 pages more of small rating to look at to get up to all the numbers. My question for you is, I look at what the services were, and only 5% were medical services. The rest were IT consultants, transcription services, music therapy, things like that. And do you think that those are areas where the people you represent could be doing those jobs that are already in the Department of Human Services? Do you think there is a number of places we could cut within that particular budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I think it's an area that I think is worthy of exploration. I know that we have folks, as well as some of the other unions like MAPE, that, for example, work in the IT area. And I know that DHS, for example, as you're well aware, seeing as committee has done some, you know, major work in some of the software programs they have and the health match, et cetera. Sitting here today, I don't have the capability to say the department could have done this or that to have a bigger bang for the buck or to
use its own employees in a specific aspect of it. What we do know, though, is, as you know from being very strong advocate in this area, that whenever they do contract out, it's supposed to demonstrate whether or not existing state employees can do that work. And some of the problem we have is those that are overlooking, whether it's at administration, whether it's sometimes short-staffed or whatever, to get that job done. I do think it's worthy of looking at, and I think it's, you know, it's incumbent upon, in fairness to the department, they should be asked to provide that sort of information to you and the members of the committee. And in Health Match, as an example, is one, as has been testified a few days ago or whatever, that it will come online. It may be delayed a bit, quite a bit of money is being spent on it, and whether our folks or others could have done that work, I mean, I can't answer that, but I think it's worth looking at, because again, we're cutting people off Minnesota Care to save a few million. We ought to see whether we can save some dollars in the contracting, too.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Schaefer? And I would ask, are there people that are here in the audience that are listed to testify that would have difficulty coming back at the 4:30 time? Okay. Maybe if our page, if you could find out who that is and then let me know, and I'll try to call on those people. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chairman Bradley, committee members. You'll be pleased to know that I brought with me today the solution to the long-term care dilemma. If you recall, I was here 3 weeks ago. I sang the song at that time that Minnesotans and Americans together must plan early, save, invest, insure. We're going to live a long life. Well, the song is the same. The chorus is the same. The verse is going to be just a little bit different. But I may start, please, by, if you would write down these numbers, 81, 73, and 2T. And I'll come back to them in a second. I didn't read the whole bill. Had I read the whole bill, I would be elderly when I finished. But I understand that there were some issues about the irrevocable trust. Basically, I will tell you that I am opposed to loopholes that are out there. I told you the last time I was here, as a long-term care professional and salesperson, Americans, Minnesotans are desensitized to the risk of needing long-term care. It's hard to sell apples on one side of the street when you're giving it away on the other side. You have a huge problem before you. 77 million baby boomers coming down. I don't envy what you have to do. But there is a solution to this. It's interesting because as I reflect on this, that all my life I've learned that there's no such thing as a free lunch, and we all agree to that, and most people do, until it gets to long-term care. Then there is a free lunch, and we expect quality care. It's not right to go on welfare when you have the means to be able to pay for yourself. We all seem to agree to that with one exception, unless it's my mom. Then the table turns, and we look at it a little differently. People are desensitized to the risk because there are loopholes available. I'll address those just briefly. You think, I mentioned last time that I attend medical planning seminars. There they are, medical assistance planning. Now the effects that this has alone, I can't tell you the exact dollar effect, but I can tell you that it's part of the anesthesia that desensitizes to the public, because they can ignore the risk, avoid the premiums, and wait until they get sick, take their chances. If they have a crisis and they need to have someone else pay for this, they can go to a lawyer's office, close the door, and get rid of the bundle of money somehow, some way. My recommendation is that people have to recognize that they're going to live a long life, as I've said before. Whose responsibility is to it? We don't necessarily need the partnership program. I've told you that, my opinion of that before. Tax incentives, tax deductibility, they're nice, but it's not necessary. What we need to do is educate the public. You're going to live a long life. If you love your family, you will take some proactive measures. And if you choose not to, now we have to employ another way to pay for this care. Because I support quality care. I support better staffing. My father was in a nursing home. I like to have people that were there to care. Unfortunately, you can make more at a Taco Bell now than a nursing home.
Excuse me, Mr. Schaefer,
I'm coming right to the end right now. And the answer is this. The answer is to tap home equity. 81% of our seniors own their homes. 73% of the seniors own their homes outright. There's $2 trillion worth of assets out there that could be used for long-term care, or after the age of 62 can be used to purchase long-term care insurance.
Mr.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do you sell long-term care insurance?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Deacon? Sorry.
Mr. Schaefer, that's why you had a quick question here.
Yeah, Mr. Schaefer, I just had one quick question. Dealing with, you were talking about, trying to get people to act more responsibly. I think there's a concern here, though, that some of the current actions being taken here will lead to more irresponsible behavior. If you believe that you're going to be losing all of your assets when you get old and you start experiencing health problems, then why save in the first place?
Well, this is the reason why you would... Well, because it's your responsibility, first of all, that you are the person who's going to live a long life. Your family will take care of you to the extent that you've made a plan. There is insurance out there, and there's a funding mechanism to pay for it if you don't have the wherewithal yourself. And now, listen, here's the other caveat. Target Medicaid to those folks that are genuinely in need. The insinuation there was that I'm self-serving, that I'm a long-term care salesperson. I advocate for quality care. Let's find a solution to this. And one of the solutions is long-term care insurance. One of the funding mechanisms is the reverse mortgage. So you have a huge problem paying for this. So why wouldn't we encourage and educate the public? This is your responsibility. For the sake of your family, do something in advance.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Thank you for your testimony. I believe I was told that Jason Douglas is one of those that would appreciate being able to testify, so we'll go a little out of order. Good morning, welcome.
Jason Douglas. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the flexible agenda. My name is Jason Douglas, and I am the administrator at Sibley Medical Center and Clinics. Sibley Medical Center is a 20-bed hospital located in Arlington, Minnesota, and the only hospital in Sibley County. I am testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association. Hospitals across the state are disappointed with the budget that is being proposed in House File 1422. There are several areas of concern that I'd like to quickly highlight. The 5% cut in the rates the state pays hospitals for caring for Minnesotans on state programs comes on top of previous cuts and inaction on medical inflation. The operating rate the state pays for inpatient care is already 19% below cost. This bill would cause a loss of $47 million in federal matching dollars. So while the 5% hospital rate cut would save the state $55 million, it would cost hospitals $103 million. The governor's proposal left at least 27,000 Minnesotans currently enrolled in Minnesota Care without health care coverage. This comes on top of 34,000 people who already lost state coverage in the last round of state cuts. The governor had proposed reducing eligibility for parents from 275% of poverty to 190%. That rate is now being reduced to 175% of poverty, causing even more Minnesotans to lose their Minnesota Care coverage. All Minnesota Care enrollees pay something for their coverage. Taking away Minnesota Care coverage leaves them with the unattractive option of spending down their assets until they qualify for other public health care programs. This bill will encourage people to move into instead of out of poverty. The Health Care Access Fund has the money to provide this coverage. The Minnesota Care Tax will generate an estimated $226 million surplus in the Health Care Access Fund in fiscal year 2007. This money should continue to be used to support Minnesota Care enrollees. Rural Minnesota depends on Minnesota Care. Small employers in Minnesota, in greater Minnesota, are less able to sponsor coverage. Their communities depend on this program to a greater degree than other state health care programs. Following the administration's unfortunate lead, this plan would hit hospitals with 23% of the proposed cuts, despite the fact that we represent just 3% of state funding. Over the biennium, the impact to hospitals would be a loss of $157.9 million. You may not realize that this bill raises hospital and outpatient surgery center licensure fees by $670,000 to pay for the Department of Health's costs tied to the adverse health event reporting system. We would like to see the funding come from a department allocation or through a partnership with the Minnesota Hospital Association.
If the lysotropy increase needs to remain, we'd ask that it sunset after 2006, allowing policymakers more opportunity to understand the department's true costs and the ability to devise a better funding source for this project. While hospitals overall have many concerns with this bill, there are some elements that deserve acknowledgement. Mental health services have been spared from the rate cuts, an important decision given the need to avoid further cuts in mental health services. Both the governor's proposal as well as House File 1422 provide funding for the return of a GAMC spend-down capability. And lastly, a statewide trauma system has been funded, something that is already in place in all but a handful of states. This kind of system promises to save time and thus save lives when it comes to routing patients to hospitals. Hospitals look forward to working with the legislature to improve on this ominous health and human services financing bill. Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Begley, this is kind of a technical financing kind of question. You suggested that there's extra money in the access fund. If you'd like, I'd be happy to visit with you sometime to trace the money and the transactions. In fact, we're using those monies to protect the overall safety net, and about the only way that you could use any of that money would be if we completely repeal GAMC and then more, because I know how much it would cost to do what you're talking about. Are you prepared then that, would you suggest that the legislature ought to repeal GAMC as an alternative?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to work through those details with you at a later date with the assistance of the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Good, I'd be happy to do that too. Further discussion? Professor Deacon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Douglas, I was just wondering if you have any ideas as far as, there's a lot of hospitals that are on the edge financially, especially out in the rural areas, which is a big issue because of accessibility. Any idea how many hospitals may end up closing as a result of this legislation?
Mr. Douglas?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have any detailed information that would specifically single out the number of hospitals that might close. I can tell you that some of the challenges that rural hospitals do face, and I've listened to testimony all morning, and we talk about improved quality of care and safer care and kind of the expectation that there's always improved technology and the latest technology in these rural areas. I can tell you situation that most rural hospitals are facing right now, we can't fund most of the electronic medical record type devices or the teleradiology type processes that do reduce cost, do provide a high quality of care, and we can also provide it in a safer manner. My personal assumption is that there are a number of rural hospitals that are struggling at this point to maintain their organizations financially.
Mr. Douglas, you did acknowledge, and I appreciate that, the GAMC spend down. I'm wondering if your hospital association could also quantify the effect of the rebasing in the second year, which I think is several percent. That's oftentimes not talked about for hospitals. And then secondly, we are moving upwards of 30,000 to 40,000 people from Minnesota Care to either medical assistance, most of the medical assistance, and some to GAMC. If that person were to walk in your hospital on Minnesota Care, you're well aware that there's a $10,000 cap. That person now on medical assistance does not have that $10,000 cap, and it seems to me that would be of great help to the hospitals. And if you could help in the balance of all the actions that are being taken, sort of help me understand what those positive effects are. I think there are some positive things that help, at least in part, to offset the 5%. Now, I'm not saying that it would probably offset all. I just don't have from hospital association some numbers on those few other things. I'll appreciate that in terms of follow-up. I don't expect answers today on that. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And I believe the other person that had asked for consideration was Dr. Bob Meeches. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Probably our last testifier before we have to break to head over to session.
Thank you very much, and thank you for accommodating my schedule. Chairman Bradley and members of the committee, my name is Bob Meeches. I'm the chief executive at the Minnesota Medical Association, and today I'm here representing the over 10,000 physicians, residents, and medical student members of the Minnesota Medical Association. We appreciate the hard work that you've put forward, and we think there are both positives and negatives in this piece of proposed legislation. As an example of some of the positives, Article 8, Section 2 establishes a Health Information Technology Advisory Committee We really like it. It creates funding for statewide trauma centers and telemedicine for psychiatric services. We think those are all steps in the right direction. I do appreciate the gravity that you've been asked to deal with here. As policymakers, you're not in an enviable position, but we do respectfully disagree with a number of parts of this proposed legislation and want to comment on two of them today. We would like to raise opposition to Article 3, Section 66, which eliminates single adults from the Minnesota Care Program and reduces eligibility for parents from 275% of poverty to 175% of poverty. We think this will lead to more uninsured Minnesotans. Our patients without insurance will delay seeking care until they're sicker and sicker, and then eventually care will be more expensive. They'll likely end up in an emergency room where the care is more expensive, and the cost to all of us will be increased. And so we believe by having more uninsured Minnesotans and saving in the short term potentially, the cost to all of us, including all of us in society, will increase. We fully understand and appreciate the state budget, and Minnesota as a whole cannot for long sustain the increasing cost of health care. It is our shared concern. We need to support efforts to reform the health care system to help addressing these issues of rising costs, and the Minnesota Medical Association has put forward a plan to do that. We think the proposed budget cuts before you are counter to efforts to control overall health care costs. And although these proposed budget cuts help in the short term, the larger number of uninsured Minnesotans will cost more in the long term. The fact that Minnesota is the healthiest state in the nation and has already the lowest number of uninsured isn't a coincidence. We have to maintain this health care safety net. The second issue I want to comment on and briefly mention has to do with Section 35 of the bill, which provides for new medical necessity criteria under medical assistance. We strongly believe that the determination of medical necessity should be distinct and separate from the determination of coverage. While we certainly acknowledge that coverage services should be medically necessary, we are concerned that the existing language, the proposed language, sets a very strict standard and overemphasizes the cost component. More importantly, the language is focused on diagnosis and treatment of conditions and fails to add the critical need for preventive services. And we'd be happy to work offline with you to discuss our concerns in this section of the bill. Thank you for accommodating my time, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Dr. Regis. At least on the latter one you mentioned, I think that we need a lot more help from your association. There has been, obviously, I think by the data, a propensity to overuse, misuse, whatever, especially in the scanning field, some high-tech equipment that has high costs. And then, of course, that means that we're paying for it. I'm talking about our public assistance programs. And I think the reason for that language, frankly, is because of those kinds of things that we have to do something. And I wish, frankly, it was better self-managed, but it doesn't seem to be as well as it needs to be. So what would you suggest? I mean, I even have a really good friend of mine that's done enormous research that warned me that there's a new emerging cost driver called sort of in-office imaging technology. And people with self-interest are charging the taxpayer for overuse of those kinds of things.
Representative Bradley, as you know, we put forward a proposal for health care reform, and it's included in some of the other pieces of legislation brought forward in other committees. We believe there are pieces of that that address this specifically. What you're talking about is some of the supply-side economics, and we believe there are solutions embedded in there to begin to address that through use of evidence-based guidelines and through other mechanisms. And so we'd be glad to work with you and others to help begin to address that. We don't think the solution proposed in this legislation is the right solution.
Well, I think as Representative Fremba sort of put it, We can no longer sort of put off solutions. We've been 4 years in this, and we have to start taking some actions and not just defer it to the future. But I'd be very happy to continue to work with you as we have in the past. Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Meech is, we have to look at various solutions that are put out on the table in front of us, and I know the Senate has premium caps in theirs, and the only way that would ever work is by lowering, instead of passing on the cost of healthcare inflation to consumers, to lower reimbursements to physicians. A, do you support that? And B, if not, which I would suspect, have you expressed that in Senate testimony?
We have not seen what the Senate has put forward this year as far as the budget, and nor is anyway, and so we're still waiting to see that. I think our preferred solution is a formal reform, which is going to take some time. We're working with a broken system, as all of us know, and unless we make some fundamental change, we're going to continue to tweak around the edges and have this debate every year. We think the short-term solution has to do with the cigarette tax for the uninsured, and that's been our number one, two, and three solution. As you know, a cigarette tax, by all studies, is widely supported by the general public. I don't care whether we call it a tax or a fee or whatever, and that's the solution. But the physicians of Minnesota feel strongly enough, and their taxpayers, that even if we have to go beyond that to increase some other type of tax this year, we need to take care of uninsured. The premium issue, which you addressed, we'll be glad to talk to you about.
Mindful of the time, Mr. Wilkins, you have a quick follow-up?
I didn't hear an answer to the premium cap issue, and we know it's coming. It's just whether it's formally been introduced or not.
Yeah, we have not seen it introduced. We've not seen how it's been introduced. We have concerns about it is the answer to your question, and we would be glad to talk when that comes forward and see where that goes. We want to see the exact wording.
President Powell, did you have a question?
Yeah, just real quick. Dr. Nietzsche's on the medical necessity part of the bill. As I look under current rules, the way things are done now, I basically see a rule under medical necessity that is recognized as the prevailing standard or current practice by the provider's peer group. Now, if you think that perhaps what we've written in this bill is too strict, I will insist that this is way too broad. And I think it's causing us problems in what we're trying to get to as a way that makes sense when it comes to what we are going to approve for those clients that are on our health care program.
Thank you. I think we agree that there's an issue here that needs to be addressed. And we believe that it needs to be addressed through other mechanisms. We believe that we shouldn't be linking cost to medical necessity directly in the legislation. And we'd be glad to offer some solutions or some suggestions to you that we think can solve the solution. That, after all, we saw this for the first time yesterday, and so to get you language and changes, we'd be glad to do that over the next short period of time.
Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank you for your testimony. It's very straightforward, and I think what you're saying is going to come true, so thank you for telling us straight up.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you for your trust. My members, if you would put those items that you need back in your folder, we will recess to about 4:30 this afternoon, and we'll be in the basement hearing room at that time. Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair, just for Representative Wilkins' information, I'm the chief author of that bill. It's House File 153 in the Senate that has the premium caps, and I don't support that part of the bill.
We're in recess. We'll bring our meeting back to order from recess. Had a request to go slightly out of order, so we'll call forward now in continuation of our testimony. Just remind testifiers that we'd ask you to try to remain within about a 3-minute limit. We'll begin now then with Lynn Osterman and Karen James. Good afternoon. Welcome to committee.
Good afternoon.
We have a lot of committee activity going on, but we just need to move on. We're bringing some more members in as we go, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Karen James, and I represent NINDACA, which is a provider organization for day training and habilitation programs, also known as DTNHs and DACs. DTNH programs provide a variety of supports and services to adults with developmental disabilities to ensure their health and safety and enable them to pursue their personal goals. Our services are aimed at achieving community integration and developing life skills and include support in finding and maintaining employment, retirement programs, leisure, recreation and transportation, as well as psychological and behavior support. Over 11,000 Minnesotans are served by 267 DTNH programs each year, mostly in community-based employment. In fact, in 2003, DTNH clients earned over $36 million for themselves, working at over 5,000 businesses throughout Minnesota. On behalf of the direct care staff at DTNHs, we want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for proposing a much-needed COLA for DTNHs.
We also want to thank all the members of the legislature who have received many calls, letters, and emails on this issue, and who have communicated our concerns to the chair and committee members. I'll now turn it over to Lynn Osterman from the Minnesota Heart Patient Coalition.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I echo Karen James, my colleague's sentiments, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Habilitation Coalition, another provider of day training and habilitation, or a group of those providers. We are recognizing that this omnibus bill will provide a much-needed increase to the DTNH rates that were cut by 1% in 2003, and we appreciate that. A 2% or slightly more than 2% increase in COLA over each of the next 2 years would put the DTNHs in a much better position to provide the services that people with developmental disabilities need and want. Demand for DTNH services grows steadily each year. At the same time, the cost for providing services are growing as well. For example, our members experienced on average an increase in workers' compensation rates of 34% and general insurance rates of about 5%, employee health insurance expenses between 5 and 15%, and E&O insurance of 8%, utility costs of 2%, and so on. We recognize that this is a tough budget year, Mr. Chair, and we very much appreciate your leadership and the commitment of this committee so that on this important issue, and we look to you for continued work in the ensuing years as well as more money becomes available. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's see. Going back is Sue Rinda here. Good afternoon. I got more
Good
than
morning.
I'm
bargaining
for.
Brought up
Good afternoon.
Shitter. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ruth Kruger. I'm the Employment and Economic Assistance Director for Dakota County. Sue Rinda couldn't come back again this afternoon, so she asked me to pinch hit for her. I'm representing the NACSA, which is the County Social Services Directors, the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Social Services Association, the Local Public Health Association, and the Metropolitan Inter-County Association. So we're condensing all the county testimony into one for you. We appreciate the committee including the following items in their budget bill. Reducing the county share for ICFMRs from 20 to 5% in Article 5. The county cost share imposed in 2003, implemented last year, was a large cost shift to counties, and it's been difficult. The policy intended, which is to move disabled residents into community settings from ICFMRs, we're working diligently to do, but it is a long-term process, and the cost of ICFMRs has been borne by local property tax dollars, so thank you very much. Including the governor's recommendation to provide funding for treatment for foster care youth with severe emotional disturbances and funding assertive community treatment for youth, making the transition to independent living, Article 7, is a big improvement. Counties have long advocated for such initiatives as they will help improve adolescent health and reduce hospitalization and out-of-home placement, all of which are so damaging to children. Considering county perspectives in the disability choice of case management provision, Article 5, the bill includes amendments jointly developed by counties and disability advocates related to relocation from nursing home case management and liability and conflict of interest provisions. We think this language is a workable approach to allow for choice of case manager beginning that process while maintaining county functions necessary to ensure quality services for those who need them. Methamphetamine. I know over the course of this session you've heard a great deal about methamphetamine. We really appreciate the lab remediation and expanding methamphetamine treatment grants. It's been a huge issue for county government. We're glad to see emphasis on treatment and in other committees, law enforcement, and encourage you to consider additional prevention strategies in the future. Counties appreciate your attention to electronic health records and expect to continue working with their state and community partners toward this goal. It is important to recognize the crucial role governmental public health plays in the development and use of electronic systems. In fact, counties would like to see additional attention paid to electronic public health records, also known as the Minnesota Public Health Information System. As you know, counties and different members have testified on most of the provisions over the course of the session, and we're not going to repeat that. We just want to reinforce our concerns about the transfer of GAMC to the Healthcare Access Fund and reducing eligibility for Minnesota Care. Our concerns are increased by the additional changes the committee proposes to the GAMC spend down and reducing for Minnesota Care parent eligibility to 175% of the federal poverty guidelines. Thank you.
Can I ask you, Kruger, about you were concerned about the transfer. I believe if you go through the math, you'll find out if we don't do the transfer, then we probably would have to cancel the GAMC program altogether because we wouldn't have the money to cover it. Are you suggesting that?
No, certainly GAMC is a very important program for single adults. I think we were hoping there would be other funding sources for it.
Ms. Kruger, I just for you maybe to take a look at, we are through a process the counties are involved moving upwards of 30,000-40,000 people off Minnesota Care into MA and GAMC, and if we don't provide dollars, if the money doesn't follow them from the Health Care Access Fund, those people are going to lose eligibility, and I don't think any of us want that to happen.
We certainly don't want that to happen.
No, thank you. Any questions? Did you wish to? You're just there to.
I guess the only comment,
no,
Mr. Chair,
ahead,
Patricia Colwell
please
from the Association of Minnesota Counties. Also, just wanted to mention that this is a big bill. Many, many parts of it affect county government. We tried to hit the highlights in the areas that we think have the most effect on counties directly. There are some other provisions, but I imagine that we'll be talking to you as we prepare for the conference committees about some of those a little bit more, things that we like and things that we, you know, would like to see framed a little differently. Thank you.
Well, and I think clearly. This committee recognizes the important partnership with the counties, and having been there on county-based purchasing and a few of those others where I've been on both sides of it, I appreciate that very much.
We have a lot to talk about, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Next would be Matt Flory. Good afternoon. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Flory, and I'm representing the American Cancer Society. I came to testify in support of the section establishing the Cancer Drug Repository. I want to thank the committee for its previous support of this proposal and Representative Bradley for including the language in the bill. We believe this program will help help us to reclaim a lot of cancer drugs and increase access to patients that do not have insurance. Representative Abler has been a patient and persistent chief author, so we also want to thank him. We've made quite a few revisions to the bill. In the country right now, there are about 10 states that have created drug repositories of this type. All of them have provided some level of liability protection for the good faith participants in the program, and that's primarily the section that we've been tweaking on and off through the process. We think that we've come up with some language that really strikes the right balance. To provide comfort to the volunteers that would participate in the program, but not too much blanket coverage to protect them from other types of bad faith or activities not related to whether the drug was donated or not. And I guess with that, we'd just like to urge the committee to support the bill in its current form, or that section in its current form.
Mr. Ford, is there been an amendment then that's been drafted to make some changes now in this next iteration when we're hearing tomorrow? Is there some new changes, or is it all incorporated?
I think at this point the changes that I was testifying to have been incorporated in the bill.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Margaret Perryman? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Margaret Perryman. I'm the CEO at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare here in St. Paul. With me this afternoon is Jim Hattican. He's the Chief Financial Officer at Gillette. And he doesn't have any prepared remarks today, but he's here as a resource should you have questions. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. In the last 2 months, I've had the pleasure to meet with many of the committee members about our concerns about this bill. In 1897, the legislature of the state of Minnesota defined the state's responsibility in ensuring that children with disabilities have access to medical and surgical care. Gillette Children's Hospital was established by the state as the first publicly funded hospital in the United States dedicated to the care of children with disabilities. 108 years later, Gillette Children's continues that mission, and we are the major provider of medical and surgical care for children with disabilities, including cerebral palsy, rheumatoid arthritis, muscular dystrophy, abnormalities of the face and neck, spinal deformities such as scoliosis, head injuries, and many different types of abnormalities of the skeleton and muscles. We see children from every county in Minnesota except for one, Travis County, as well as 38 other states and 11 countries. Last year we treated 18,000 individual children. 75% of them were children of Minnesota citizens. Up until 1973, we were a line item in the Minnesota state budget. When the federal government established the medical assistance program, Gillette Children's was removed from the state budget so that all children could have access to care and the state could take advantage of the 50% federal match for the care of children with disabilities. We are a Medicaid hospital, more than any other hospital in the state. Nearly 60% of our children are MA eligible, and the MA program is responsible for 30% of our revenue. We embrace that mission, and we believe that we have had a strong partnership with the state of Minnesota for these 108 years. Our role in that partnership is to make sure that children with disabilities receive first-rate medical care during their childhood so that they can take their rightful place in society as they become adults. Adults who were once our patients have become business and civic leaders in our state. They are architects, librarians, production workers, artists, greeters at Walmart, teachers, business owners, social workers, mail carriers, and healthcare workers. We have been told by thousands of children and their families that we have made a difference in their lives, and we are proud that the families that have chosen us to provide health care to their most precious children. We believe that we have held up our end of the partnership. It has been the policy of Minnesota to support care of children with disabilities with a cost-based reimbursement program. State policymakers have long taken the position that the state should pay the cost of care attributed to children in an NFK program so that these costs are not shifted to private business. However, this is no longer the case. Since 1998, the state participation in the cost of care has slowly eroded with a 5% rate cut in 2003 and now a proposed 5% cut in 2005.
Ms. Perriman, we're well over the time we'd suggested, so I'd ask you to come, if you can wrap up before too very long.
All right, I agree there. In addition, the state has not rebased the Medicaid program since 1998, and other changes with resulting in smaller payment decreases have been instituted. If the proposed 5% cut is instituted in this biennial budget, the state will be reimbursing Gillette Children's at a rate that is approximately 19% below cost. We've accommodated a series of cuts through decreases in our budget, limited cost shifting, and increased reliance on donations. However, all of these strategies have limits, and that is why I'm here today. We have accepted our cuts from the past years quietly, but we have reached the end of the point at which we can now accept more cuts. We have very few choices left for how we might accommodate those cuts, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you today that I'm going to tell our patients and their families that we will cut services or eliminate care to certain children because that is, quite frankly, unjust. However, these cuts will severely limit our ability to meet emerging needs and the needs of children born with disabilities in future years. The cuts that we have weathered are cumulative. They won't make us close our doors today, but they drive an increasingly bigger wedge into our financial infrastructure and result in slow and insidious devolution of of our ability to provide care. I am here today because we must avoid becoming the frog in the pot of boiling water.
Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Perryman?
Yes.
Okay, that's correct. I wanted to make sure I had the right name. I'm wondering, too, in addition to that 5% cut, what the effect you think will be on cuts to Minnesota Care and also the emergency services cut, emergency room, that people can't get paid from the programs if it's not indeed an emergency. I was thinking about a case, and I don't know if this would apply, but I know that you see children with leukemia and other things, and while they're going through all their treatments, they have a lot of problems in the middle of the night and all the time. But I'm thinking if a child had a heavy fever and stomach pains, and the parent brought them to the hospital in the middle of the night thinking that it was appendicitis or thinking it was from the steroids from leukemia or something, and then found out that it was only the flu or something, then do you see potential loss for the hospital in uncovered costs that you provided the care already, but then the department deems that it's not an emergency, Department of Human Services deems it's not an emergency? Do you see additional uncompensated costs coming from that area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare provides services to children with disabilities that are primarily physical and functional disabilities. We don't see children with leukemia, nor do we have an emergency room. And then the first part of your question about Minnesota Care, we also, most of our children are eligible for medical assistance and not Minnesota Care, so I'm not really able to address the issue related to Minnesota Care.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for the work goes on. If you can follow up, well, let me ask first of all one question, then maybe a follow up. Do you receive a disproportionate share?
Yes, Representative Bradley, we do.
Okay, and then what I'm wondering about is the fact that we have a spend down being reinstated. If you could sort of quantify what that's going to mean. I think you said, though, in your case, you're pretty much medical assistance, so that looks like that wouldn't have any effect on you.
That's correct.
That's fair, yeah. Then I think the Minnesota Care wouldn't make any difference either because you said I think yours is a unique situation. Yeah. There is some talk, however, frankly, it didn't seem like it quite developed to the maturity level, but I wouldn't be surprised that we might see it, but of a dish approach of some sort that might be used to help out places that have a higher proportion. Are you familiar with some of those proposals?
Yes, Representative or Chairman Bradley, I am. I want to point out, however, that a one-time dish allocation does not fix the infrastructure problems that we have. And while we certainly would appreciate that kind of that money, and we are the largest disproportionate share hospital in the state, it is just a one-time only event.
Thank you for reminding me of that. It would be important to remember. Well, thank you again for your testimony and for your good work.
Thank you.
Deb Jacoby? Speaking of good work.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Dick Dirks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Dental Association. Ms. Jacoby and I are here together to talk to you about matters relating to dental access to dental care for low-income patients. First of all, I would like to thank you for including in House Bill 1422 funding for the continuation of the Donated Dental Services program. This is a program that's got its first 2 years under its belt right now, and it's gotten off to a good start, and we believe it has a significant payback for the small amount of state money that goes into it. There's a much greater return in the amount of dental care that is donated by dentists and dental labs, and we think it's a very cost-effective program, so thank you for that.
Excuse me, has that ever been quantified?
Yes, and we can pull numbers together. We do have numbers.
It'd be good if you can follow up, because I think you're absolutely right. Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, thank you.
That was pretty good stuff.
Secondly, I'd like to thank you for including in the bill the repeal of Rule 101. While even though this was requested by the Department of Human Services and the Department of Employee Relations, we believe that Rule 101 has been a barrier to participation in a program by Dennis, and we think this will be a step in the right direction. And in addition to it eliminating a barrier, we think it will be an important part of helping to get off the ground a new dental access program called the Oral Healthcare Solutions project. We're looking for some startup funding for that program, but it's a very extensively planned program whereby almost all of the players in the dental community have come together to plan a new delivery system. And we believe something needs to be done to better address dental access. And this program has the potential to accomplish a considerable amount of dental care for the same amount of state dollars that are there. It addresses many of the barriers to participation that dentists have experienced, including increasing reimbursements, patient care that would be coordinated by a health center, and reducing no-shows from the health center. And so we're looking to establish a demonstration program, and we hope that you'll be open to help us get that program going in the near future. And Ms. Jacoby, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay, we'd like to then continue and add a few more comments.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, my name is Deborah Jacoby, and I'm the project coordinator for the Oral Healthcare Solutions Project and director of program development for Appletree Dental. Dr. Helgeson, our CEO, and I both wish that he were able to be here today, but kind of ironically, it is the work being done on dental access in Minnesota that causes him not to be here. He was asked by the California Dental Association to come help them with a meeting to develop an ideal school dental program. So,
sounds like a good cause to me.
Yes, and the word of our work is out. But I am here to speak on behalf of Dr. Helgeson and over 50 organizations and individuals who partnered throughout 2004 to design a new oral health care system for Minnesota health care programs. Our partners included the Minnesota Dental Hygienists and Dental Assistance Associations, the School of Dentistry, the Dental Hygiene and Assisting Programs, community clinics, health plans, Head Start, Community Action, state agencies, and many others. And the theme that I would just like to repeat that Dick made is that we're here with a solution to some long-standing problems, and we believe that they'll provide you a return on your previous investments in dental access. The Oral Health Care Solutions Project was funded by a $150,000 dental access grant and with a bold charge from DHS. We used that to leverage time, knowledge, and resources of all those partners. I'm sure that the in-kind contribution that partners made far exceeded that initial investment. The system we designed is promising enough that we received commitments from dental providers in three regions of Minnesota to increase services to public program patients if DHS proceeds with the pilot project. And I think that's really noteworthy given what I'm sure you've all heard from MHCP enrollees of not being able to get dental appointments. Our pilot project includes a number of cost-saving strategies, including the earliest possible prevention, education, and triage provided cost-effectively in community-based settings by dental hygienists under collaborative agreements with dentists. So those are some of the things that the legislature has provided us with, and we're putting those into action, hope to put those into action. The savings that this will produce, and that will be immediate savings just with lower overhead and more cost-effective provision, different workforce strategies, and long-term savings from improved health and reduced treatment costs will be used to coordinate care and to increase reimbursements to levels that will allow dentists to participate in Minnesota healthcare programs. We do understand the difficult budget decisions that you face and that states simply cannot afford to provide large one-time startup fundings at the level that we originally envisioned and hoped for, but we believe that now more than ever the legislature needs to take the first step. Appletree has a history of successfully leveraging resources, and we know that corporations and foundations will help build on public funding, especially when it comes at such difficult times as this. Our efforts to raise additional funds are already underway, and we will try to come back over and keep folks posted on that. You've already invested in improving access to dental care through the creation of the Dental Access Advisory Committee, by funding Dental Access and Clinical Dental Education Innovations Grant, and by giving much time to discuss the current problems. The Oral Healthcare Solutions Project synthesizes all these previous efforts and brings many divergent interests together. We're ready and willing to move forward with the pilot and hope that we'll be able to come back the next time and tell you about the successes of that.
Thank you very much, not only for your testimony, but for the great work that you do on an important issue, dental access.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sue Abderholman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Minnesota, and we appreciate the opportunity to comment on this bill today. I just tried to make it easy, so I laid it out into three areas: support, areas of concern, and things that we oppose. I'll start with the good. We certainly support the exemption of mental health services from the 5% rate reduction. Clearly, we know that mental health treatment is usually a loss leader, so this is helpful. We support reducing the parent fees under TEFRA. There are families who have children with serious emotional disturbances that are under the TEFRA program that were impacted by the parent fees. We like everything in Article 7 dealing with mental health, especially the clarifications for custody relinquishment, adding telemedicine, treatment foster care, psychiatric consultation, and ACT services for young people 16 and 17. And we do appreciate the provision related to postpartum depression and education, and thank Representative Finstad for his work on that. I would like to add that we also do support the authority of the commissioner to close down the campuses when they're not needed any longer. In terms of clarifications or changes needed, we believe the Medication Therapy Management Advisory Committee should have someone on it who has experience in the treatment of mental illness. We really do like the approach of using polypharmacy and algorithms more so than necessarily medication management, but we want to make sure that we have someone on there who understands mental illness. Under the medically necessary section on pages 55 and 57, we'd like it clarified that medications are not covered under this new section. There's already language in statute dealing with new drugs that are coming on the market and, you know, in a different part of the statute. And so, you know, this just doesn't seem to fit to kind of throw drugs in there with some of the other treatment protocols. Additionally, the advisory committee on non-emergency transportation services should include consumers, and we would appreciate if someone who is ambulatory but needs special transportation services is on there. Often we forget about people who might have a real serious mental illness that really can't take regular transportation, and there were some bills that were introduced earlier this year that seemed to limit those services just to people who are non-ambulatory, and we're forgetting about a whole group of people who maybe can't do that. We'd also like to mention that there will be savings to counties by moving treatment foster care to medical assistance, and we would actually like to see some of those funds retained at the county level for children's mental health services. As you know, NAMI is opposed to Minnesota Care being eliminated. About 30% of the people under Minnesota Care have a mental illness. We have really been pushing, I think both because of new treatment options and better medications, for people with mental illness, newly diagnosed, to go back to work as soon as they're able. And we know quite a few people who are on Minnesota Care but have schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, really serious depression. We also, while we appreciate the spend-down provision being added back to general assistance medical care, you know, especially with Minnesota Care being eliminated, the 50% of poverty figure is just really low, and we really have some concerns about that in terms of what that would mean in terms of people's income. We also would hope that the entire section on co-payments, as you know, we've not been a real supporter of co-payments. We had hoped that that would have been deleted, particularly the bad debt policy provision, which we believe clearly conflicts with federal law. And we also want to make sure that as more drugs for treating mental illness become generic, that people have a time period to really work with their physicians to make sure that, you know, we've looked at what maybe the possible reactions would be or whether there should be something else they should be on. And with that, I tried to time it to 3 minutes, adding in an extra few seconds to say my name.
You did wonderfully. Thank you. President Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and
Just so you know, I think in the author's amendment you'll find that for non-emergency special transportation, you'll find that we have substituted a person there from the disabled community. May not be exactly what you wanted, however, a member of the disabled community will be on that board.
Great. Mr. Chairman, Representative Paul, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. The Brain Injury Association, Tom Gold. Good to see you again. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Bradley, members of the committee. Good evening. My name is Tom Goad. I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota. I want to thank you for your work you've put into this bill and appreciate the daunting task you have before you and your willingness to take public input. I do want to address several issues. The first is the inclusion of the cap on the medical assistance home and community-based waivers. For many people, the TBI, CADI, CAC, or MRRC waivers are the only way out of the institution. It will be difficult to capture the savings from individuals relocating from nursing facilities if we just rotate people from waiting lists into the same beds we just emptied in the nursing facilities. It's been demonstrated over and over that it's more cost-effective to serve someone on a waiver than in the nursing facility. The current proposal moves the state closer to saying you must do your time in a nursing facility to access the waivers. So as long as we maintain waiting lists, we perpetuate and backfill the more expensive alternative. Second, I appreciate the inclusion of the personal choice for relocation service coordination. It is one more option for an individual to facilitate their return to the community. For the past 4 years, the number of people under the age of 65 in nursing facilities has remained relatively constant, and this could reinvigorate the process of allowing people to return to community living. We were disappointed to see the choice of waiver case management by county or private providers is not moving forward. But I want to thank the counties for working with us, and we'll continue to work on this issue. I would urge you, the committee, to challenge the department's fiscal note that I believe is flawed. The Brain Injury Association provides contracted waiver case management with several counties, and it would appear it does not increase the number of hours needed to provide case management. And their assumption that a significant number of consumers would dump the county case managers for private is not consistent with what we've seen across other programs that opened up alternatives. And finally, I want to thank and commend this committee for including the Shaken Baby educational video. Every time we walk to the microphone here, we're talking about brain injury prevention and how it's going to save the state money. And this is one area where I think you'll capture an immediate savings by reducing the number of infants sustaining a traumatic brain injury by being shaken. In fact, you may want to look at the potential cost savings and capture it yet this session, which I don't believe has been captured in either the House or the Senate. Thank you, and appreciate your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Ewan, are you and Mr. Cheater going to be together? Great. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Ewan. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. I'm here to thank you for a number of the sections of the bill that you've included into this omnibus bill and to also express a couple of concerns as well. As you know, we have worked with Representative Wilkin to create the Minnesotans with Disabilities Act of 2005. One of the main goals of this bill was identifying strategies to get and help move people with disabilities who are under age 65 out of nursing homes. This goal is achieved by the provisions that are included into this bill, and we want to thank the committee for including those in. This bill also makes a number of other positive changes for people with disabilities as well on a number of fronts, including increasing the COLA, the changes to the Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities program, and also the changes for parental fees. We knew from the start when we were working on our bill with Representative Wilkin that we would have a very high-cost bill that was going to need to be pared down, but the information that we've learned as relating to the cost has been very useful as we've been identifying creative ways and cost-effective ways of meeting the needs of people with disabilities. Mr. Chair, we do have three concerns about the bill that we also want to express as well. Our coalition is very concerned by significant cuts being made to Minnesota Care. I know that the committee has characterized these cuts as being made to able-bodied adults without children. However, the concern that we have is that, according to Department of Human Services estimates, about 40% of the people affected are people with a chronic illness of some kind, including mental illness and also multiple sclerosis. For my clients with MS, they are typically the people with non-visible symptoms of MS. Their only symptom is, or their primary symptom is fatigue. They aren't disabled enough to qualify under the standards for medical assistance because they don't have enough symptoms yet, but yet the access to the prescription drugs that they're being able to access through Minnesota Care is what's helping them keep from further disability. It's quite a conundrum for many of my clients. For many of my clients, these cuts will upset the delicate balance of being able to afford health insurance that meets their needs. We are also concerned with Article 3, Section 82, found on page 105. This section relates to the planning process for managed care for medical assistance services. We have discussed managed care for people with disabilities numerous times with Representative Wilkin, and our coalition has been very impressed with the work that has happened in recent years relating to the Minnesota Disability Health Options Program. This is a voluntary managed care program under medical assistance available in four metro area counties. However, one of the reasons that the disability community believes that this program is working is that it is voluntary. We're feeling that this section may not be necessary because there is a planning that is being sought for expanding the Minnesota Disability Health Options, and that's you will find that on page 194, lines 17 through 21. What that does is looks to expand managed care for people with disabilities in a voluntary way across the state. Our final concern is also on page 105, and this is section 84. This is a proposal relating to the sliding fee scale for, sliding scale premium for medical assistance. This section does not provide us a great deal of detail as to how this would be accomplished for people with disabilities, especially people with disabilities who use a medical assistance spend down. We have some obvious concerns for people with disabilities who are already required to spend down monthly deep into poverty to qualify for their medical assistance. In some cases, some of my clients are spending more than 60% of their monthly income, usually through a Social Security check. 60% of that income is already going towards their medical care. People, quite frankly, can't afford to have an additional squeeze put on them with the premiums on top of that. So that is a section that we are looking to find out more information about and how that would relate to people with disabilities and their spend downs. Once again, I do want to thank the committee for the work that you have done on behalf of people with disabilities and certainly your willingness to work with our coalition on these critical issues. This bill does make a number of advances for people with disabilities, and I think it's something that we can be proud of from that perspective.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yeah, just a clarification on that. Was that Section 84, was that in the governor's proposal, or is that new? And the second question is, are we booking any savings to that? I'm losing.
The answer to both questions. First of all, it's new. If you recall when we had our idea sharing, it was one of the ideas that I put forward. And there are no savings because you can't book a savings until you get a waiver. That's a waiver. Yeah. And I think the issue that you brought up, it's one I hadn't thought about. I think we're thinking about more of the traditional family, that kind of a thing. But where you do have a spend down involved, we may have to figure out something because I understand the interaction. That's not what was intended. But, I mean, we're seeking a waiver, so we're a long way away from something. So we have some time.
We understand that. That was part of what we needed clarification on
sure,
as well.
Sure. Yep.
Mr. Chair and members, John Sheeta from Courage Center and co-chair with Mr. Uland.
of the Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities. Three additional provisions of the bill that we do support, and they may seem small. The first was referenced by Representative Powell, the Medical Assistance Transportation Advisory Group. We're working with Representative Powell to add a member of the disability community to that committee that will work with the department and a few members to evaluate that MNET program and to make sure that that proceeds and expands in a thoughtful manner to provide quality services. Article 5, Section 33 of the bill is the interagency work group that we created to bring together the Department of Human Services, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and stakeholders, counties, members of the disability community, and others upon invitation to really look strategically and in a planful manner at services for the disability community, in particular to watch as this choice of nursing home relocation case management provision rolls out, how that functions, and how we can better move people from institutional settings to more community-based settings. And the dental study that we're also calling for, Article 5, Section 32, we hope we can come back next year with some recommendations to improve access for people with disabilities to needed dental services. We're very pleased with the choice of nursing home relocation case management provider that is included in this bill. We see this as a major step forward. We had a great deal of cooperation from the counties and DHS on this provision. I think we are disappointed, fair to say, very strongly disappointed that there is nothing in this bill related to waiver case management. In 2003, this committee and the 2003 legislature asked the department to prepare a report. Included in that report was to be proposed legislation to provide choice of case manager related to the waiver programs. That was due January 1st of this year. We had hoped that that would be a part of our discussions with counties, and that report was just made public on Monday of this week. Frankly, we are disappointed in the contents of that report, which does not comply with the mandate that the legislature asked and the elements that were required of that report. So I hope that we will continue to work with the counties. Those conversations over the last several months have been very productive. We have come a very long way, and I hope that we will continue to work with the department in the interim to come forward with legislation for you next year on the same subject matter.
Thank you.
Could we just get a copy of that report, if whoever is from Human Services here?
I would suspect some follow-up. I mean, we by virtue of them being members, oftentimes we get the copies, but I'll try to be watching myself. I haven't seen it yet, but of course I'm a little backlogged in the mail. Well, I want to thank you for your work, and actually this isn't very much fun, but maybe the word will get back to him. You got it done in spite of having an impediment, and that is having to work with Wilkin. No, he did a great job, and you did a great job. Thank you very much for your testimony. Tina Welsh. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm actually Kathleen Murphy.
Okay.
I'm here on behalf of Tina Welsh.
I'm sorry, what's your name?
Kathleen Murphy. And I do have a letter from Ms. Welsh of the Duluth Family Health, Duluth Women's Health Center. And I'll just read her testimony on her behalf. Dear Chairman Bradley and committee members, as Executive Director of the Family Planning Clinics that serve five counties in northeastern Minnesota, I represent the state-subsidized family planning clinics in all of Cook, Lake, Carlton, and Couchiching counties, and in the southern portion of St. Louis County. I write this testimony to implore you to reconsider the elimination of the funding of the Family Planning Special Projects Grant Program and restore these grants in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Budget Bill, House File 1422. These clinics have received funding from the state of Minnesota for 23 years, and each year have been able to help over 200 women in Carlton County, over 200 women in Couchiching County, and over 160 women in Lake and Cook counties. These are the only family planning clinics in these counties, and we do not compete in any way with Planned Parenthood for the FPSB grants in this part of the state.
I understand that your reason for eliminating the FPSP funding is due to the federal Medicaid waiver that is expected to be implemented in July of 2006. But I don't believe you and your committee fully understand that the waiver and the FPSP are intended to be complementary programs and that both are necessary for an effective public health approach to preventing unplanned pregnancies. The states that have had the most success with implementation of the waiver have kept their family planning grant programs fully intact. The Medicaid waiver is a cost-effective, fee-for-service approach to providing family planning medical assistance to those that qualify. Let me emphasize, the waiver pays for only a medical exam relating to family planning. It does not provide for outreach, education, or such services as HIV testing and a counseling visit. FPSP is a cost-effective way to reach other high-risk populations who might not otherwise qualify for Medicaid or the waiver, but who do not have good access to preventative health care and education. FPSP is essential for keeping a family planning infrastructure intact for those populations most at risk for unplanned pregnancies. Please look at the research throughout the country that shows the savings to states that invest in family planning services. Conservative estimates in Minnesota show that for every $1 million cut to family planning, taxpayers will pay an additional $3 million in increased MFIP and MA costs within 3 years. I refer you to the attached sheet for further information. In a time when we should be trying to eliminate unintended pregnancies and the need for abortion, the elimination of family planning grants is extremely short-sighted and will take us in the opposite path. Thank you for your consideration. And I would just also like to remind you that the governor's position does not decrease family planning. And information that I recently received from the Department of Health does show six other states that have the waiver, where none of those states reduced their family planning monies, and that California and Washington actually increased their state family planning funding. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Peg Labor, and I'm the executive director of a state-funded family planning agency called Family Tree in St. Paul. I appreciate the opportunity to present some facts about family planning funding in Minnesota to you today. I understand that some members of this committee feel that because Minnesota has been granted the 1115 waiver, there is little need to continue state funding of family planning services under the FPSP program. As the current chair of the State Association of Family Planning Providers, I can tell you that my members would vigorously disagree with that assumption for the following reasons. The 1115 waiver and the Family Planning Special Project grants will in no way duplicate each other. The waiver project is intended to reduce state and federal Medicaid expenditures for maternity care by expanding eligibility and access to family planning services, and thereby reduce the number of births resulting from unintended pregnancies. Currently, FPSP funding contributes to the success of that goal. More low-income individuals without insurance will be able to enroll in the waiver program and have access to family planning services, and the provider community considers that to be a tremendous advancement in the prevention of unintended pregnancies in Minnesota. In the waiver fee-for-service approach, there is limitations as to what can be covered in a medical visit. The waiver provides no funding for the wraparound services that make family planning visits work for many clients. FPSP funding, on the other hand, supports a variety of services like basic clinic infrastructure, as well as services such as the state family planning and STD hotline, and community education and public information. In 2004 alone, Family Tree educators provided 701 free educational sessions to 12,655 individuals and community groups. This service will be lost if the state eliminates its support for FPSP grants. A critical public health function performed by family planning clinics and often overlooked by the public and policymakers is one of acting as an early warning system to the public health sector. We are the frontline defense in public health efforts to reduce unintended pregnancies or disease transmission. Reimbursement from the 1115 waiver will not cover a standalone STI visit. The waiver will only pay for SDI services if they also include services related to family planning. A major question whose answer will unfold as the waiver is implemented is what if individuals decide not to enroll in the program or are deemed ineligible by virtue of slightly higher incomes than will be qualified. It is the intention of the clinics to do everything in our power to promote the waiver option, but we have no assurance that people will have any interest in filling out the application or that they will qualify when they fill it out. These individuals still present a public health concern. They will need family planning services, and without FPSP money, we will have no way to serve them. Allocating money for family planning services is one of the most cost-effective ways Minnesota uses its public funds. There are few other programs where for every dollar the state spends, it reduces other expenditures by the state by $3. I urge you to consider the overall effect of cutting FPSP funding will have on the system of pregnancy prevention care in Minnesota and on the total of state expenditures for health and welfare. I am positive that once you understand these facts, you will restore full funding to FPSP. Thank you for your consideration. I have a copy of my testimony, and I also have a copy of the last allocation process for FPSP funding, the amount of money that was requested, the amount of money that was allocated, and the additional need that was identified.
I give that to our page. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, Aaron Murphy. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Aaron Murphy. I'm a registered nurse and the executive director for the Minnesota Nurses Association. With over 18,000 members, MNA is the oldest and largest voice for nursing and our patients in Minnesota. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. While we are pleased with the increased funding for nursing homes and for the people that work there, nurses are increasingly concerned that as a result of the governor's budget and the additional cuts proposed in the House proposal, that more people will receive inadequate care or no care at all. If enrollees are cut from these programs, it will only add to more cost to the overall system since they will continue to need and receive health care services. Disease prevention and health promotion are at risk for those losing coverage. Annual visits to the clinic for a checkup will become a thing of the past for those losing coverage. Investing in prevention of disease not only saves money, as I know you know, it embodies the nursing's respect for human dignity. Instead, people will wait until their health care needs are so great that they must seek care in emergency rooms across the state, both in urban and rural areas. Emergency rooms are a critical segment of the health care system, but it's not the place for ongoing treatment of chronic disease like diabetes and arthritis. Yet we do not believe restricting the definition of emergency care is the answer either, as often this is the only choice for patients to receive care, and we do not believe there is sufficient data to support this change at this time. The choices made in this budget process will affect the care and the essence of a life lived for thousands of our fellow Minnesotans. The choices before you are important and difficult. We urge policymakers to use a balanced approach in dealing with the deficit. The Minnesota Nurses Association supports a dollar increase in the cigarette tax as a way to both increase revenue and improve public health. Please consider this option before making these drastic cuts. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Kathy McDonough. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kathy McDonough, and I'm an attorney with Legal Services Advocacy Project in St. Paul. We represent low-income clients throughout the state of Minnesota who come into legal services offices with issues of concern. We have some concerns about some of the proposals in House File 1422. We understand that there have been some difficult choices that have had to been made here. Unfortunately, some of the choices have a negative impact on many of our clients. Our biggest concern is the elimination of Minnesota Care for Adults Without Children and the reduction of the GAMC spend down. The proposal to eliminate Minnesota Care coverage for adults without children and move as a safety net GAMC for individuals with income of 50% of the poverty level will cause significant hardship for many Minnesotans with chronic illnesses such as heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and mental illness, and others who have been determined disabled but who must wait 2.5 years for Medicare eligibility. 50% of the poverty level is approximately $388 per month. Because GAMC requires a 6-month spend down, enrollees with income as little as $600 a month must incur $1,272 in medical expenses before being eligible. This will leave many poor people with medical debt that they are not able to pay and increase uncompensated care. We have some other concerns about some of the provisions in the bill, such as denying medical assistance coverage for non-emergency visits to a hospital emergency room and for services that are not part of an emergency visit. It is not clear that federal Medicaid law would allow this. Congress has clearly contemplated that MA would cover non-emergency visits to a hospital emergency room and allow states to charge a higher copayment in that situation. And Minnesota has enacted this higher copayment. Minnesota will lose federal funding in implementing this provision. In addition, the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment in Active Labor Act, or EMTALA, requires that any patient who comes to an emergency department requesting examination or treatment must be screened. So, for example, if somebody falls and injures their leg and goes to a hospital emergency room thinking it might be broken and later gets an x-ray and finds out it wasn't broken, would that be covered or not? So we have questions about that. We also have concerns about reducing Minnesota Care parents' income to 175% of the federal poverty level. That's about $1,800 a month for a family of two. And I understood yesterday from Representative Bradley that this would be 9,200 people that would be affected by this. These are working. Is that the correct figure?
Well, it depends on what you're comparing to.
Okay.
It was about 2,800 or 2,700 more than the government proposal.
Okay. But these are working parents who do not have access to employer-subsidized insurance, and they'll lose their health care. Minnesota gets federal funding for Minnesota Care parents, so we would also lose that federal funding.
Excuse me, just to remind you, we are on time, or you're over your time. If you can wrap it up pretty soon, I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, I've given it to you in writing, so if you have any questions. We do have concerns about some other parts of the bill that we think need federal approval. We would like to work with you or the department on some of those concerns.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, Representative Powell, sorry.
Thank you. 2 points that you brought up, denying medical assistance coverage for non-emergency visits to the hospitals.
Right.
You bring up the point that perhaps it might not be federally compliant. The department has checked on that. There does need to be a little tweaking that is going to be placed in the bill as it's presented here tomorrow. On the EMTALA screening of a patient who subsequently determined not to have an emergency medical condition may result in uncompensated care. In that particular instance, the screening does not have to be done by a doctor. It can be done by a nurse at a triage desk. So basically, it's kind of a wash. And in fact, I believe that they may even be able to charge a minimal fee for that type of screening.
Okay.
Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me again about the Minnesota Care federal funding issue?
Ms. McDonough.
Mr. Chair and Representative Goodwin, the Minnesota Care waiver receives, under the Minnesota Care waiver, the state receives federal money for a federal match, and I think it's about 50% for parents in Minnesota Care. So we would lose that federal match.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gubin.
So if we cut parents off of Minnesota Care, we'll also lose the federal dollars that are attached to that. And do those federal dollars, well, I should maybe shouldn't be asking you this, and I don't know if you know, but I'd like to know if those federal dollars go back into the Minnesota Care Fund, or are they used by the department for other things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I believe the dollars are used to reimburse for services provided to Minnesota Care enrollees.
And one more question.
I'm not sure that I understood the answer. In the places where we have waivers in Minnesota Care and we get federal dollars, that matches an actual expenditure. If you don't make this expenditure, then you don't get the match. So the federal dollars wouldn't be there because you didn't make the expenditure.
Right. Mr. Chair, is that a one-to-one match, do you know?
It's 50-50. 50% Minnesota spends 50 cents.
They
spend
50 cents back, so it is one-to-one match. Thank you.
Person Thiessen?
Yeah, just is that broken down in the spreadsheet, how that match works out with as a result of these?
Representative Thiessen, no. I pretty much what's showing on the spreadsheet are either general fund dollars or healthcare access dollars, and we tend not to focus on the federal dollars. I mean, we're a $7 billion business in terms of general fund, and then I think we're about $16 billion by the time you add all of the federal matches and other dollars. But we pretty much focus on the general fund, healthcare access fund.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if someone from the department is here and can get us that information, that would be helpful. Just on those waivers and the effect of the, because those waivers really are for the people that are being proposed to be put off Minnesota Care. It's those working parents, I think, right? That's what the waiver mainly applies to.
You have to be sure. I think in general it's for the children. Mr. Chun, do you know for sure on our waivers?
Mr. Chair, there's been a series of sort of amendments to the waiver. I believe originally the funding was for the children and then it extended to two groups of parents.
And that's what allowed us to push it up to a higher level at some... Well, anyway, I appreciate that. Thank you.
I don't think it allowed us to push it up. We were using a variety of rationales as we extended different waivers, which, by the way, are expiring big time, and that's why we're moving a lot of people to MA and stuff like that's happening. So, thank you very much for your testimony. Alan Seagram? I don't know if I should say good afternoon or good evening just yet, but I'll... Good afternoon.
Right.
Welcome.
We'll stick with good afternoon then. Thanks for your time, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Seagren. I'm here from Children's Dental Services, which is a nonprofit public health dental clinic. And I'm here to speak with you today about the fate of the Minnesota Dental Health Program and the Minnesota Department of Health. As many of you may know, under the governor's proposed budget, that $72,000 item is being cut, which I understand is much less money than much of the things that you've been hearing about so far today. However, this small line item is doing an incredible amount of work. If we're talking about spending smarter here in Minnesota, this is an excellent program to talk about. Oral health, of course, is a vital aspect of overall health, as I'm sure many of you know. Poor oral health and untreated oral diseases can have significant impact on general health. For example, oral diseases have been associated with heart disease, stroke, low birth weight in babies, failure to thrive. Oral diseases can cause complications in diabetes, pneumonia, cancer treatments, and transplant therapies. The fact that oral health is a real requirement of overall well-being is being recognized as such within Minnesota and nationally. That includes in the Surgeon General's reports on oral health, in the Healthy People 2010 national goals, in the Healthy Minnesotans 2004 goals, and overall. The governor also in the current budget is proposing a major new methamphetamine initiative, which once again ties to oral health if we look at, for example, meth mouth, as it's colloquially known, in terms of the oral health ramifications of methamphetamines, such a tricky word, abuse. The Minnesota Dental Health Program
both allows Minnesota to meet its Healthy People 2010 goals. It attracts federal dollars. It provides a resource center for oral health information and resources. It creates a strong and informed public health dentistry voice for community issues ranging from fluoridation of water to the effects of pregnancy on oral health to, as I said, meth mouth. This program currently is at the $72,000 level. That includes only one full-time employee, which begs the question of how much can one person do in the face of all of Minnesota's oral health needs. However, the fact of having one person on all the various committees, the federal dollars that this attracts, and the fact that it does allow one common resource for these goals has such a strong impact that, for example, under Oral Health America, a private program which did grading for all the different states, Minnesota received an A for our oral health efforts and public health efforts, whereas if this program is cut, we'll switch all the way down to an F. So I'm here today, briefly, to remind you of the importance of this effort and to ask for you to look at ways of funding this very small amount of money to continue into the future.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Powell.
I'm looking at the spreadsheet here, Mr. Chairman, and I don't see that, where the government is cutting that program. And I just wondering where it's at. It's under Department of Health, is that correct?
Mm-hmm, that's correct. It's under the Minnesota Department of Health. It was cut, and I believe the money was put into the methamphetamine initiative as well as the positive options abortion initiative. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact citation for you at this time.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it would be fair to say that those were the trade-offs. There were many, many budget transactions, and I don't think anybody can say the money went from here to here kind of thing. And I don't know, for example, we probably have to follow up with the department or something. Sometimes it can be part of a grant system, and you don't necessarily see that specific name, especially in that amount.
Right.
That's exactly probably the case.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Do you have any idea what grant, I mean, is it part of a...
I don't, but I certainly can follow up.
Yeah, maybe we can follow up with some help with the Department of Health, find out which grant programs. It's probably somewhere in a group of grants or something, because we have done quite a bit of consolidation of grants over the years.
Exactly. Okay.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Thiessen had a question.
Same question.
Same question. Okay.
When I...
Great minds?
Yeah, or something.
Well...
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Judy Hawley? Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Judy Hawley, and I'm the executive director and a physical therapist for the Minnesota Chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. I want to just briefly come before you to thank you, in particular Representative Bradley and Representative Samuelson, for your support of Article 5, Section 23, related to reimbursement for health care services, for home care services. Studies do show that home care... there's substantial savings over nursing home care, and this part of the bill does increase reimbursement for home care services by 5%, and we appreciate that. I think this will have particular impact on those home care agencies that are small, that are rural, that serve a great number of MA patients. There's been much talk over the last many years about how to decrease health care costs, and I think providing home care, keeping people in their homes, is a good way of doing this, and this is an incentive in that direction. The paperwork that home care therapists have at this time is very burdensome, and so appreciate the increase in reimbursement. Thank you for listening to our concerns about funding for home care services and for including this in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Ms. Hawley, just I know you'll want to jump on and help us out with this. The bill has 5% in the base bill. You may, if you've looked at the detail, know that we have what we call sort of a Plan B option. Plan B option would probably almost quadruple that 5%. I think it would be close to 20%. So you might want to go out and encourage people to vote for a certain bill that would help to raise that additional money, and we could even do better.
We will take a look at that.
Okay.
Thank you.
I haven't given you much detail. Thank you for your testimony. Twyla Braze? Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening, members. I have testimony that will be handed out shortly. I'll be quick. One thing that we really like in the bill, which I labeled dental freedom, which is the idea of getting rid of the Rule 101 and really letting practitioners have the freedom that they need to see the patients that come in, and it also allows individuals to probably access more dentists than they would otherwise. We are very concerned about the sweeping change in policy, which on the testimony we called government in the exam room. Really a lot of interference in the patient-doctor relationship. And generally what I would say is that when you look at the fact that the bill says it's the responsibility of the commissioner ultimately to determine what medical items and services are medically necessary for the medical assistance program, that's an enormous amount of power over whatever the physician might think is necessary. And of course it says after that the fact that a provider has prescribed, recommended, or approved a medical item or service does not in itself make it medically necessary. Well, if you go down on what we have under there, you'll see that we're concerned about the fact that the commissioner gets to authorize what treatments guidelines would be used and only those are considered medically necessary. We're concerned about the creation of a health services policy committee, which we really think is perhaps putting into place the Oregon Health Plan without actually putting into place the Oregon Health Plan. And then as well requiring proof before new devices, drugs, or procedures are included. And, you know, we asked what suffices as proof. Does it have to be beneficial to the individual, to a group? How many people have to wait for that proof to come? And, of course, we are concerned as well about defining emergency. When does that happen? How does that happen? And we just point out a contradiction about the new copayment for non-emergency services, that if medical assistance doesn't pay for non-emergencies, why is there a copayment? We're concerned about the fact that the trauma system is not voluntary and that the health department is exempt from rulemaking requirements, that they, essentially as you build advisory councils around the state, that we are growing the size of government. And then we really don't think it's the right role for government to be telling parents or telling hospitals how they have to educate parents. And, you know, we're not sure exactly where this will end and what will be required next year from hospitals and doctors and such. Then you get down to the government surveillance piece where we know that the legislature is interested in making a statewide health information system, but we wanted to make it clear to you that a Harris poll has found that 47% of the public believe that privacy concerns outweigh the benefits of such a network as proposed by President Bush. And then the trauma surveillance system, which is being created. And I thought that before I came, I would just quickly pull this off. So I pulled this off out of the health department's final rule, is what I think what they called it. And it's the draft of a report of injury. And so going to the health department would be things like the provider number, the social security number, the medical record number, the patient account number, whether there was alcohol involved, suicide, what were their diagnoses, when did it happen, when were they admitted, where did it happen, did they wear a helmet, what kind of sports injury, et cetera. And all that information is going to be going to the health department without the patient's consent. And I just, at the very bottom of it, you'll see that we're concerned about where the provider tax is going. We've never supported the provider tax, and now we see it being used for new things. And we just point out that missing from the bill really are free market solutions that put the cash and responsibility for these cost value judgments into the hands of the patients who are really the ones who know what they need. And the government, it's just not possible for government to make the detailed treatments that people need using all the intimate details about that person's life and then coming up with what that person needs. That's not what government does. Government doesn't do that well. Government does things in lockstep. It doesn't do it individually. And so those are our concerns about the bill. But I will tell you that with the Rule 101, we just make a comment that we really think that should be extended to physicians as well, that neither should they have to follow that rule to free up the system. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Powell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the medical necessity concerns that you have, physicians now aren't the ones that make the determinations. That's done by the department under current law and current rule. And it's done through a medical review agent, which makes a determination based on current guidelines under medical necessity. Those guidelines are quite broad. In fact, you could drive a truck through them and almost anything would count. What this does is really just tighten it up. The process would basically be the same. It's just that the medical review agent would be making a determination based on a tightened up statute.
Mr. Chair,
yep.
Representative Powell,
Ms. Mays.
I understand that, and I think that this current law as it stands now, still, that's not the right direction to go with the Medicaid population. And as you say, this just tightens it down, and we see it tightening down more and more and more. And we see the propensity there for actually rationing care according to whoever those people are that are sitting around the table making the decision. The moving more and more towards tighter and tighter decision making at the government level is not the right direction. The system needs to be freed up so that the individuals have the cash in hand and can make those judgments themselves.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
President Paul,
I agree with you on that. You and I are in agreement of people having cash in hand to make determinations, but these are the people that have our cash in hand. And the problem has been is that there has been misuse of facilities and how they obtain services. This is not a means to deny services to anybody. It's to make it more appropriate in a more appropriate setting, is all this language would do.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Brace.
Representative Powell, perhaps you misunderstood. I really feel that the medical assistance, Minnesota Care, et cetera, programs need to have maybe our money in their hands, but in a different way than they have it now, so that it is not a top-down control approach, but so that the individuals can make the decisions, much like cash and counseling. That program in the disability community, where they get the cash and they get to make the decisions, and they have been found to make much better decisions with much greater satisfaction.
And one more.
Representative Paul.
I'm in complete agreement. If you can figure that out, let me know, because I agree with you on that. And
thank you for your testimony. Shirley Hopkinson.
Whoa.
welcome to the committee.
Thank you. So to getting down, Mr. Chairman, to the hardcore, Stephen, I know here. My name is Shirley Hopkinson, and I'm appearing before the committee today on behalf of REM Minnesota. I'm here to comment on, one, the cost of living increase for providers of services to people with disabilities, and two, the reduction from 20% to 5% of the county share of the non-federal cost of ICFs that have 7 or more residents. As I have noted in previous testimony before the committee, REM offers a wide array of services to people with disabilities, including residential services provided by the ICFMRs as well as the waivers. Through its services, REM strives to empower people with disabilities to live, work, and participate in community life. In a recent letter to her legislator, a REM staff member wrote, "Employees on a daily basis are trainers, educators, and role models. They are truly one of our society's most valuable employees and deserve to be compensated fairly. They are in this field to serve people because they believe it is a noble profession." REM could not agree more. With respect to the county shift, the current 20% county share has made some counties reluctant to fill ICFMRs. If this trend were to continue, a viable community residential option, the ICFMRs, will have been removed as a choice for many consumers. Without a repeal or a considerable reduction as this omnibus bill provides, there will continue to be disruption in the lives of many consumers. This provision in the bill will ensure stability in the lives of many consumers. The 2%, 2% COLA, or possibly 2.2%, 2.3%, will assist REM and other providers of services for persons with disabilities to continue to provide high-quality services. Minnesota has a proud tradition, a long tradition, of providing and serving our most vulnerable people. This provision carries on that tradition. REM thanks and appreciates the work of Representative Bradley in crafting the omnibus bill and specifically the provisions to which I have referred. We look forward to working with all of you throughout the remainder of the legislative session and beyond. And Mr. Chairman, I neglected to take out that beyond. I should have. That might imply special session. No, I mean beyond that. So,
thank you. Can I book that?
Yeah, right. Thank you very much.
That's a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Okay. Ms. Wilkins, and I'm not going to drill you on the amount of money that's actually in there for staff increases, because I promised you I wouldn't, and I made my point on that. But I do want to ask you about what kind of insurance the staff have that work in ICFMRs, and how many of them are actually insured, and those types of things.
Ms. Wilkins?
With REM specifically,
right?
Insurance is offered there. Most of the insurance, however, with REM, as I recall, is available only after 1 year of employment.
Okay.
And I can get provisions there. There are three choices for insurance. And then, of course, there is the coverage for the single employee, and then there is the separate family insurance. I've looked at these, but I can't quote them. But I'm free to get you as much information as you'd like on that.
Ms. Hogan, and that's available then to all REM employees?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
That's a good one.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Wilkinson, then as far as you know, they're not giving insurance for the first year, so they would be potentially Minnesota Care recipients. What about when Mr. Husted testified this morning, he later wrote an email and said 94% of the nursing homes offer health care, but only 20% of the people take that health care. And my question back to him is, why not? Because I know that the high number of people are single parents that work in nursing homes, and I know that a high number of people are single or single parents that work in ICFMRs as well. So I am wondering if you know what the insurance, I think some of these offer the bare minimum, and they charge the employee for the policy rather than the employer paying a good percentage of that policy, and I don't know if REM is that way or...
REM matches. There's a match there, Mr. Chairman and Representative Goodwin. And how can I say this? I got the information out in the car.
that's how you can say it.
Yeah, right. But I'll be sure to make that available to you, a breakdown.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thanks a lot.
Mr. Steve Larson. Not to give you any pressure, but I believe you might be standing between this committee and eating or whatever. I don't know for sure. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota, and the ARC provides advocacy and support for persons with developmental disabilities and their families. Now, earlier today, Susie told me that bad news was I was the last presenter, but the good news was you were waiving the time limit. Has that rule changed?
No.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm here to thank you for Article 5, Section 1, which addresses parental fees. This committee made parental fees a priority this session. After hearing testimony both in the committee in early February and through town meetings that we've held the past 2 years, House File 619, I believe, was one of the first bills that the committee passed. And several thousand families will benefit from your action, and We hope that at the end of the session we'll bring relief to these several thousand families. So thank you very much for that. We also were dealing with an issue over the past several months on consumer-directed community supports, which is an option under the developmental disabilities waiver. And with administrative changes that have been implemented to bring some consistency to that program, many families, several hundred, were informed that their individual family budgets were cut. Working with Representative Bradley, the Department of Human Services, and counties, we were able to agree to some cost-neutral exception process, which will also benefit these families, allow them to keep a consumer-driven system going that has worked effectively for them and addressed many of the worker needs that this committee has reviewed over the past few years. So thank you for including that language in House File 1422. Part of a consumer-driven system is also the ability, when there are problems or when there are needs, to have your services reviewed. And the Region 10 Quality Assurance Project has done an excellent job and received national recognition for the job it has done in providing a voice review process for individuals with disabilities, not only developmental disabilities, but also individuals with brain injury. And it allows a team, volunteer team, to come in and review with the person what's working or not working with them and design a process to improve that. And that's vital to a consumer-driven system. So we want to thank the committee for recognizing this, including it in the funding, and also funding a statewide study that will look at expanding this type of system statewide, not only for persons with disabilities, perhaps for the elderly in the future, and we're very excited about that. We're also a member, the ARC of Minnesota, of the Coalition for Citizens with Disabilities, and we knew that we had an ambitious bill, and we're glad that some significant portions of that bill were included in the omnibus bill, including the Nursing Home Relocation Service Coordination, the COLA, and the Interagency Work Group. We plan on working closely with the Interagency Work Group and our membership in looking at a number of issues, including the waiting list issues that are growing because of the limits on the waiver growth in the caps, and we're looking at a consumer-driven system. We think that one of the solutions to future budget issues is to empower individuals both under a cash and counseling model and under the models that we've been demonstrating in Minnesota for several years, our consumer-directed community supports, that these have great potential for being much more cost-effective in the past and putting the consumer in the driver's seat as far as how their health care and other dollars are spent to provide them their vitally needed supports. So with that, we'd like to thank the committee for these areas in helping out persons with developmental disabilities, and I stand for questions.
Well, Mr. Larson, I assume I speak actually for the whole committee, but it seems to me that every year that I've been here, ARC Minnesota has done a yeoman's work on unlock the waiting list or whatever historically we might have talked about, and in many of the things you mentioned, although we have the good fortune sort of the final product, but I know that you and your organization and the good people that are part of it had a lot to do with it. I appreciate it and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you for your testimony.
Have a great dinner.
Yeah. Or whatever else we have to do. Some of us have ways and means and things like that, too. So, with that, members, I believe that completes Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, last night I made some comments that I believed about restrictions put on people that were here to testify, and I'm happy to see that I saw no restrictions on people to say whatever they chose to say.
That was, as I indicated to you, it was really unfortunate whoever's spreading those kind of rumors.